You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm currently on a book tour around the United States and hope to see you. Find the schedule of my events at warisalie.org. It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Margaret Kimberly. She writes at freedomwriter.blogspot.com and at blackagendareport.com, where she is editor and senior columnist. She is also on the administrative committee of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. Margaret Kimberly, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I have loved Black Agenda Report since it came into existence, and its predecessor site before that. How is Glenn Ford doing these days?
He's doing fine. We're busy. We're always busy, especially in an election year. A lot going on, but we love what we do.
Well, that's good, and a lot of us love what you do. And I loved an article you wrote recently, and I very much agreed with it, though it made some points I hadn't thought of, and that is an article you wrote called "The Democrats and the SCOTUS Scam, the Supreme Court Scam." Tell us what that was about.
Well, you know, it's every time those of us who are on the left express any dissatisfaction with the Democrats or with the Democratic presidential candidate, the thing that keeps us in line is the federal judiciary and the president's ability to make these, it is very important, these lifetime appointments to various federal courts and to the Supreme Court, obviously, too. But, you know, this latest choice with Scalia's sudden unexpected death and the opportunity for a Democratic president to really have a better court that people who call themselves leftists or liberals or progressives or wherever people fall on that line, to have the kind of court we want and the kind of court that keeps many people going back to the Democrats despite dissatisfaction on so many issues. But first of all, the Republicans immediately said they weren't going to consider anybody. They decided to take a chance and hope for a Republican victory in January and then get the 5-4 court that they want. But Obama chooses, he has nominated Judge Merrick Garland, who he appointed to the D.C. Circuit Court. But Garland is a conservative. Not on the Scalia Clarence Thomas level, but more conservative than I think most Democrats want, definitely more so than I want. He has, in the past, he was among the just judges who ruled that prisoners at Guantanamo had no rights. His decisions involving criminal cases, he has decided against criminal defendants two-thirds of the time. So he, you know, and people who follow business cases say he is very much pro-business in his decisions. So it's, you know, it's a litany of things that I don't like, but this is how we're always kept in line, and it's already begun. We have to stick with Democrats no matter what, because the Republicans are so terrible. And the Republicans are terrible. I'm not going to argue in favor of the Republicans. But it's a losing game also to just keep sticking with the Democrats no matter what. As a result of many other issues in foreign policy, domestic policy, I am of the mind that we need to just dump the Democrats. I have voted green for presidential candidates the last few elections, and I'm going to do so again. And I'm urging people to make a break with the past, to take that chance. And it's not insignificant. I'm not saying that it is an easy thing to do, and it's something that requires, I think, debate, reasoned debate, but not just this fear that keeps us allied with people who never end up doing what we want them to do.
It does seem that when you get into this lesser evil argument around voting, that the Supreme Court nominations are absolutely central, and yeah. somebody is going to scream Supreme Court at you just as surely as bringing up War and Peace, they're going to shout World War II at you. And
yes.
And yet I think President Obama floated at least one other right-wing Republican name prior to this one, and the candidate took himself out of the running. And in the case of Merrick Garland, I believe George W. Bush was actually looking at nominating him as well. So you have to squint pretty hard to see the distinction here, but I guess the argument is just always there could be somebody even worse.
I think too, we have to keep in mind that yes, there can be somebody worse. There could be, you know, Scalia could still be alive. There was a case today about unions in California, which pretty much would have gutted the ability of unions to collect dues, and would have been another blow against labor organizing. But the court deadlocked 4-4 with, you know, after Scalia's death. So it does show you how important it is, but I think we need to stop focusing so much on electoral politics at all. We've had our greatest changes in this country outside of the electoral process. In the 60s, in the early 70s, during the civil rights movement, the black liberation struggle, however you want to call it, black people experienced their greatest gains when most of us couldn't even vote. Most black people lived in the South and couldn't vote at all. And yet this overpowering, this mass action that was constant, that was unrelenting year after year, that changed things for millions of people for the better. We would not have had the Voting Rights Act, although they've gutted that now, but we would not have had the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. We wouldn't have Medicaid. We wouldn't have Medicare. We would not have any on the programs, the, you know, food stamps. I could go on and on.
I think it's an incredibly important point that is very, very hard to communicate to people who hear nothing but you are powerless and all you can do is vote, all you can do is vote, all you can do is vote, over and over right. and over again. And it makes me not want to talk about the election anymore at all when I finally have someone on the phone who gets it, that actually changing things requires a nonviolent mass movement, that we aren't going to just vote change in place. But I think the other reason I have trouble with this lesser evilism that mm-hmm. Obama really seems to have put a stake through the heart of with his Supreme Court pick is that every 4 or 8 years that goes by, the better choice of the two is more evil than the evil choice was 4 or 8 yes. years ago. And we had to vote less evil because of how evil that person was. And now we have to vote less evil when the person we're voting for is even more evil than the demon of 8 or 12 years before.
I know. It gets worse and worse and worse. We have our current president who has bailed out the banks that created so much misery, which first Bill Clinton, let's talk about him and the role he played, getting rid of the Glass-Steagall Act and just giving the banks, the financial service industry, free rein to destroy the economy in this country and around the world. So then we're left with that legacy when the bubble finally popped, and Obama bailed them out. As for foreign policy, Obama's more dangerous, I think, than any Republican. The Obama doctrine basically means don't send U.S. troops abroad, but it means intervene everywhere. It's imperialism without sending U.S. troops anywhere. So you can destroy Libya. So you can try to destroy Syria. So you can make Russia an enemy when you don't need to make Russia an enemy, to impose sanctions, to wage war by other means. finally turn the corner with Iran, but that was because the Europeans said they weren't going to go along with sanctions any longer. So it was, his hand was forced. But so every president gets worse. So no one ever turns the clock away from clock back from imperialism, from neoliberalism. It's all about giving rich people more and more and more, not doing anything for working people. You know, the first 2 years Obama was in office, Democrats controlled both houses of Congress. Did they raise the minimum wage significantly? No. So now they talk about raising the minimum wage all the time now that Republicans control Congress and they can't do it. But when they had the chance to make a significant increase in the minimum wage, they didn't. So everyone's talking about this, you know, $15 an hour minimum wage increase in California, but it takes 6 years to go into effect. By the time it's $15 an hour, you know, inflation will have made the $15, you know, worth no more than $30 or something. So, So they, when they are in power, they don't do what we want. We don't have card check. We were supposed to have card check. It was going to make it easier for people to unionize.
Right, the Employee Free Choice Act of the campaign of 2008.
Exactly. Abortion rights. The Democrats can't or don't seem to be interested in winning in state legislatures across the country. So abortion rights are eroded further and further and further every year. Defunding Planned Parenthood. I don't know how many states now that has happened in. So I don't see the gains that we are supposed to get. Democrats just, and they also use the Republicans to try to keep people quiet. And now there's this, I'm going to call it propaganda, that Obama's the best president ever. He's the greatest president ever. Don't you think he's the greatest president ever? And that's supposed to shut us up now, from through now and until January 20th when he leaves office, and to keep us in the thrall of the next Democratic president, or even from Democrats in the opposition, not to ask for too much to be quote-unquote realistic. So I think the Supreme Court is among the issues that that have proven to me it's time to start over. And, you know, people keep, I hear from time to time, we need a third party, we need a third party. Well, we have third parties now. We have third and fourth and fifth parties. So you can vote for one of those that exists already. And I think this wistful, we need a third party, like as if someone's going to bestow a party upon you instead of taking the reins ourselves. And if we are going to vote, stop voting for the Democrats, and to talk about action away from electoral politics keeps that from being kind of a, I think, from frankly, it's a fantasy, even by people who say that's something that they want to see.
Yeah, we're speaking with Margaret Kimberly from Black Agenda Report and freedomrider.blogspot.com. I think you make a very important point about how Democrats talk about progressive initiatives when they're in the minority, and then when they get the majority, don't act on it because it's just something to campaign on rather than something to do. And my favorite was back in 2006 when the Democrats were elected to a majority in Congress, overwhelmingly on the issue of the Iraq War, and Rahm Emanuel said, "We're going to keep it going so that we can run against it again in 2 years." I mean, just openly.
Well, he was even more cynical. He raised money to try to defeat anti-war Democrats in primaries.
Oh, that's right. Keep the war going and elect pro-war Democrats. Yeah,
exactly. So, you know, he's a real piece of crap, but, you know, not to be put too fine a point on it. But yeah, that's, you know, the cynicism is just breathtaking. They know what we want. They know what we would like to see. And they pretend to give it to us and then, you know, always find a reason to snatch it away. And the Republicans moving, I say now that we have a far-right party and a center-right party. By moving further and further to the right, it's easy for Democrats to hold up Republicans. I have joked sometimes that Obama pays the Republicans to say terrible things about him, to, you know, say he's not an American citizen, he's a Muslim socialist Marxist Hitler, he's, you know, whatever number of names they call him, and the disrespect. I've said that, you know, he pays the Republicans, because that's another thing that keeps Democrats in line, too. Oh, they've treated him so terribly, they're so awful, they don't give him credit for anything. And so I think that all works, frankly, to his advantage.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. I had on this show last week an author named Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, whose book was called I Heart Obama, and was pretty much a love letter to President Obama about how she and other African Americans just love him no matter what. And she sort of talked about how she had all this great hope, how he would be a bringer of progressive change. Who knows why people had this hope for him, and then was disappointed, but was outraged that anyone would voice that sort of disappointment in public, you know, as if you're supposed to lobby politicians in private somehow. but then whenever, you know, Obama fails to do anything, she blames the lack of public movement, of a public pressure moving him to do things, for his lack of action. And so I asked her how, under this sort of regime of excuses for President Obama, could he ever have done anything wrong? And she had no answer, you know.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's like somebody described it to me this way once. It's like in our personal relationship that, you know, it never works out when you tell someone not to love somebody. That never... That never, ever works out. And I think it's the same thing with him. But I think we, you know, even in political activity, Americans have been very depoliticized. And it's basically about having somebody you like. For a lot of black people, seeing a black president, something that was always debated, could a black person ever be elected? You know, Colin Powell almost ran for president. Could it happen? Could it happen? Could it happen? And then it does happen. And the degree of pride I get it. I understand where it comes from. But there comes a point with this, you know, this unrequited love. It's just embarrassing to me. I think people ought to be embarrassed. I mean, the Republicans do help them out. But I think there's a level of not non-political, just fantasy and wanting somebody that you like, and just loving somebody, having someone in a position of power that you can admire. I think that's part of the appeal of Bernie Sanders, frankly. I don't think he's definitely not a socialist. He's just an old-school Democrat. He's the way most Democrats were 50 years ago.
Right.
And that's, you know, and that's not a bad thing, but it's not being a socialist. And Hillary Clinton being on the wrong side of so many issues and being so obvious in her, you know, her wickedness, I'll call it that, makes it easier for him to get more credit, I think, than he deserves. And I'm not saying people should not back him if they want to, but people have found someone to love. And over the weekend when, you know, the bird landed on the podium and people just lost it. And I was like, folks, really?
Yeah,
sometimes birds fly.
Like,
I mean, it was a lovely moment. It was a, you know, a memorable moment, and it was kind of cute. But, you know, people started to, you know, almost worship him. And there is a desire for change, but it's not going to come from hoping for a better Democrat and looking for somebody you like, you can like more. Because in the substance, his domestic policy is better. His foreign policy is not that much different. He hasn't said anything about not intervening. He hasn't said he's going to end drone wars. When he talks about Russia, he says we've got to contain Putin. I don't know why Putin has to be contained. Putin hasn't done anything to the United States. So... But it, you know, it goes on. Every 4 years, the search for somebody who, you know, can be liked more than the last person.
Well, let's put our minutes where our mouths are, and understanding that elections are not the most important, much less the be-all and end-all of social change. UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, organized a peace rally in New York a couple of weeks ago because the issue of peace and demilitarization just wasn't there in the presidential election entertainment. What was that about, and how did it go, and what happened?
Well, we, if you listen to the debates, there seems to be there's some nuances, but not much difference in foreign policy among Democrats and Republicans, except for Donald Trump, who's, said he wouldn't have invaded Iraq or killed Muammar Gaddafi. But at any rate, very little discussion of foreign policy at all. And all of the candidates saying pretty much the same thing. We at UNAC, which is an umbrella organization, it's a coalition of other groups, International Action Center, Vets for Peace, People's Organization for Progress, Black Agenda Report is a member. Realize that we, and it's something we always do, but that this was a perfect moment to be very public in our opposition to U.S. foreign policy. And we had a, old-fashioned rally in March. We started at 34th Street and marched to the U.N. We originally was going to start at the U.N., but we realized that's a dead space. It would just be us and our 10 best friends. So there we were in Midtown Manhattan on 34th Street, right across from Macy's. And we got several hundred people, I'd say 500 people there, a great list of speakers, myself and many others. But it's the kind of thing that I like to do. It's, putting my money where my mouth is, so to speak, to be very public about what we need in this country. And I think it's it can be a starting point in changing minds. I think there are a lot of people who know things need to change, but they don't know exactly what. Nobody tells them. And to hear people say, no, we should not have wars. No, the United States has no business choosing a government for Syria. The United States has no business trying to put Ukraine in the Western sphere of influence and antagonizing Russia. There's no reason to have sanctions against Venezuela. It should not be sending drones to kill people in, fill in the blank, Somalia, Iraq, Pakistan. And to talk about the, now it's a week ago, the terror attacks in Belgium. Well, this happens because there's anger, and I'm not justifying anybody being blown up in an airport, but this happens because there's anger about Western foreign policy, U.S. and NATO foreign policy. So it's important, it's very important to take and make opportunities to be public about the changes we would like to see in this country. I think we've seen that is still the way to go, the Occupy movement, which was unfortunately short-lived. But I think that proved there is still an appetite for mass action. And I think there's enough dissatisfaction for people to be moved by the sight of seeing people saying publicly, wait a minute, we don't have to go this way. This is the way we can go. And there's so many people who just don't know that there's any alternative in our media, the corporate media. The reporting is so horrible. It's even if you want to know what's going on in the world, you're not going to find out reading the New York Times and the Washington Post. This past weekend, it was huge. Syria, with the help of Russia, is continuing to push ISIS out of Syria, and we captured the ancient city of Palmyra. And the New York Times keeps going on and on about antiquities, which I'm not unmindful about antiquities, but anything other than giving Russia credit. Putin has said over and over again there should be an alliance to fight terrorism. And he has said that the West has no business deciding who runs Syria. So this was a huge turn of events. But it's, you know, it's as if it didn't happen. It's, you know, right down the memory hole. But the more people speak out in whatever ways we can, the more we can move that needle and give people information that they need.
Margaret, with about 2 minutes left, this raises an interesting question. I watched part of the video of the rally that UNAC had in New York, and I recommend it to people. And I watched your speech, and I watched Deborah Sweet's speech, my good friend Deborah Sweet. And I noticed that you said, "We're always against war." And I don't know exactly what you meant by that. I don't want to put words in your mouth. But Deborah got up there and opened her speech by saying, "Now, I'm not one of these people who's against all wars." And, you know, I heard you mention a second ago giving Putin credit, presumably for waging war in Syria in a better way than the United States is waging war in Syria. Are we against all wars?
Well, I should say this. I'm against U.S. intervention. I'm in favor of every sovereign nation being able to make its own decisions. I'm opposed to one country forcing another country to do a certain thing, or to tell a foreign leader you have to go, or to as in Libya and in Syria, to back certain people to overthrow a sovereign government. It's not America's business who runs Syria.
Is it Russia's?
Syria has a right to fight back and to ask for help. So when Syria, actually it's Russia that is within the bounds of international law, not the United States. The government asked Russia to help. Syria had been invaded by foreign armies, by terrorists backed by the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the other Gulf monarchs, other NATO nations. And they have a right to say that we want help. And when we look at Syria, we look at this country that's been destroyed, something like 9 million people displaced, 500,000 people dead. It's all because of the United States and its allies. All those people could be in their homes. No one would be starving if the United States hadn't decided that it could take out another regime and exact regime change. So my preference would be for there to be no war in Syria. But I think it would be very dangerous if the United States just gets to do what it wants without any opposition, without any resistance. And they were able to crush resistance in Libya, unfortunately, which brought us ISIS, gave ISIS a, you know, now Libya is like ISIS HQ. But Iraq, Syria, Libya, all of America's interventions are responsible for ISIS getting a foothold in those places. So I suppose it's I can correct myself and say that I'm never against war. I'm against intervention of one country by another, but I am in favor of the attacked nation being able to defend itself or ask others for help.
Well, I'm very much with you as far as that goes, and we could go on, but we've run out of time. Margaret Kimberly, read her writing at blackagendareport.com and freedomwriter.blogspot.com. Margaret, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. I'm traveling around the United States right now doing events with my new book, War is a Lie, second edition. I hope to see you. Find the schedule of events at warisalie.org. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, when Massey Energy, the biggest coal company in Appalachia, polluted the groundwater of the community Massey CEO Don Blankenship lived in, he had employees run a private water line direct to his mansion while fighting off the lawsuit from his poisoned neighbors. That's just the kind of guy he is, and it's decades of that behavior, as much as the 2010 explosion that killed 29 people at Massey's Upper Big Branch mine, that led to Blankenship's sentencing this week to a year in prison on a charge of conspiracy to violate mine safety standards. Media celebrated the sentencing as the first time such a high-level executive received jail time for a workplace safety violation. But shouldn't we question why that is? And why was such a serious charge, after all, just a misdemeanor? We'll talk about the Blankenship case and corporate crime in general with attorney Bruce Stanley. He's been representing people fighting coal and chemical companies, and fighting Don Blankenship in particular, for many years. What to make of the case of the so-called King of Coal in just a moment. But first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press. Much has been and will be written about the Panama Papers, a cache of documents from the offshore law firm Mossack Fonseca, released by an anonymous source to the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung, and then to the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and other outlets. While some seem dazzled by the mere size of the leak, makes the WikiLeaks release of diplomatic cables look puny by comparison, says a Washington Post contributor, whether the U.S. press will really thresh out the significance is another story. The data gives a glimpse into the many ways global elites hide their wealth, and it implicates politicians along with drug dealers and arms traders. But journalist Robert Perry and others remind how charges of corruption have been used selectively as propaganda tools against official enemies. Salon's David Dion notes that one reason for the relative absence of Americans from the roster is that they already have a perfectly good place for their tax avoidance schemes right here in the United States. The U.S. has failed to sign international agreements about financial transparency, allowing several states to make money by offering themselves as safe places to stash your secret bank account. And while media coverage focuses on, as CNN put it, potential malfeasance in democracies, autocracies, and dictatorships alike, The Intercept's Glenn Greenwald points out that the deeper scandal is what's legal, not what's not. Most of the shell companies set up in Panama to avoid paying taxes are perfectly legal because global elites have written the rules to make it easier for the wealthy to hold on to their wealth. The D.C. press corps are in a sort of feeding frenzy over Bernie Sanders' interview with the New York Daily News. Sanders, you will have heard, avoided specific answers to many of the questions posed. He couldn't name the specific statute for prosecuting banks for their actions in the housing bubble, for example. And writers at The Washington Post, The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, and CNN suggested that that raised fundamental concerns about his grasp of the issues. Politicians are fair game for criticism, period. But as Dean Baker noted on Fair.org, we can also check for consistency. So the same Washington Post, which told readers that Sanders' interview exposed that, quote, once the revolution happens, there will be lots of loose ends to tie up, loose ends that Sanders either hasn't grappled with or doesn't want to, close quote, also described a speech by House Speaker Paul Ryan as offering the, quote, high-minded, clear-eyed, aspirational message that has made him a Republican Party standard bearer, close quote. Ryan the Clear-Eyed, Baker notes, has repeatedly proposed a budget that would shrink everything other than Social Security and Medicare and other health care programs to 3.5% of GDP by 2050. That's roughly the current size of the military budget, which Ryan has said he wants to increase. That leaves zero for everything else, like the Justice Department, the park system, the State Department, the Department of Education, the FDA, the NIH, food stamps, and pretty much everything else that the government does. That's not according to a gaffe that Ryan made in a speech somewhere, but to a Congressional Budget Office analysis done under his supervision and with his approval. Finally, media viewed Donald Trump's assertion that there should be some form of punishment for women who have abortions through their election narrative lens. Another outrageous thing said by the outrageous thing sayer. Incoherent and hypocritical, said one outlet. A key factor in his Wisconsin loss, said another. When Trump sort of walked the comment back, that made for another round of stories. But as Jody Jacobson of the site Rewire, formerly RH Reality Check, noted, the hue and cry, including from Republicans, over Trump's statement was political theater at its most insidious. Given that, while dressed up as concern for women's safety, the laws and policies pushed by the anti-choice movement and its politicians already punish women, up to and including sending them to prison. Jacobson cites the web of entrapment that harms women seeking abortions a little at a time. Mandatory waiting periods, closing of clinics, meaning women have to travel great distances, and then having cut off avenues to safe clinic abortion, cutting off access to medication abortion, and then when safe and legal abortions have been made too hard to obtain, making self-induced abortion a crime and putting women in jail. The state of Indiana determined Purvi Patel's pregnancy loss was a self-induced abortion. She's serving 41 years while her case is on appeal. Likewise, media chuckled over Trump's idea of making Mexico pay for a border wall by seizing remittances, money sent to Mexico by Mexicans working in the U.S. Good luck with that, said Barack Obama. Economists say it would backfire, Newsweek said, and cited someone from the World Bank saying, if people can't send money legally, they'll just send it illegally. It could be disastrous for both countries' economies, the magazine said. Would that that had been media's attitude last year, when Merchants Bank of California, the last U.S. bank to offer money transfers to Somalia, stopped doing so, citing regulators' concern that money might somehow find its way into the hands of terrorists. That meant the end of remittances sent to family members in Somalia for basic items like food and medicine, money that contributed more to Somalia's economy than all foreign aid together. Was it just being quietly carried out by the state rather than noisily announced by a political candidate that made that measure seem less outrageous or cruel to the press? You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Twenty-nine men died April 5, 2010, in an explosion at Upper Big Branch Mine in Montcoal, West Virginia. The mine was run by Massey Energy, and Massey Energy was run by Don Blankenship, a looming figure in the region whose tight control over his workplace was notorious. Blankenship racked up profits and political capital, along with safety violations, while saying cartoon villainous things like, I don't care what people think. At the end of the day, Don Blankenship is going to die with more money than he needs. After an investigation spurred by the Upper Big Branch explosion, Blankenship was indicted and convicted in December for conspiring to violate federal mine safety standards. And he was sentenced this week to the maximum penalty on that charge, 1 year in prison, along with a fine and a year of supervised release. That is better than nothing, but how do we get to better than that? Attorney Bruce Stanley has represented people combating coal and chemical companies for decades. The story of his and colleague Dave Fawcett's many-year legal battle with Blankenship and Massey Energy is the subject of the book The Price of Justice by Lawrence Lehmer. He joins us now by phone from Pittsburgh. Welcome to Counterspin, Bruce Stanley.
Thank you, Janine. I very much appreciate being invited to your show. Well, news accounts note that this conviction is the first time such a high-ranking executive has been convicted of a workplace safety violation. And I guess my question is, why is that? It can't be the first time that one has been guilty of one.
That's certainly a fair statement. I think in this particular circumstance, there's a long history of blankenship actions in the coal fields of West Virginia that, with the culmination of the explosion of Upper Big Branch, ultimately law enforcement and prosecutors at the federal level had to say enough is enough and had to move. It's important for your listeners to remember that while 29 died on that April day 6 years ago, a total of more than 53 men died in coal mines operated under Blankenship's leadership from the time the company was a publicly traded company on the New York Stock Exchange going back to 2000. I had worked on the Aracoma mine fire, which one of the cases Mr. Lamer talks about in his book, and we were almost offended by the lack of action by the prosecutor's office on the criminal front in that case, and let the federal judge who accepted the plea bargain in that case, which resulted in a plea of 11 misdemeanor counts and one felony count against the operating subsidiary company only. He allowed that plea bargain to go forward despite the fact that prosecutors had said as a part of that agreement that they would not look upstairs. They would not look to the executive offices of Massey. And so we urged that it be rejected, and unfortunately it was not. And in our view of things, that was the equivalent of a get-out-of-jail-free card for Don Blankenship, an unintentional approval of the way he had conducted business to pass. And in my estimation, one of the very reasons we ended up with that with 29 dead miners 6 years ago.
Well, I want to draw you out on that not looking upstairs. It's a personal interest of mine for many years now. If people don't know, if we're talking just about the explosion at Upper Big Branch, three people did get sentenced to jail for that for periods between 21 months and 3.5 years for things like falsifying records, disabling a methane monitor, tipping off officials of safety inspections. What's galling is that tipping off officials that a safety inspector is on site is not a rogue employee action, you know. It's an order from above, you know. And so that's the question. Even if Blankenship were not the kind of guy that he is, who requires reports every 30 minutes, including nights and weekends, you know, even if he was not that kind of micromanager, why is it so hard to say the person in charge is the person in charge?
I think it really is cultural in many aspects. If you look at the socioeconomic structure of Appalachia and the influence the pervasive influence that the coal industry has had over Appalachian politics, you know, for over a century now, that reveals some of the answer. I mean, the local political structures that are in place are there, frankly, through the permission and consent of the coal companies. A good example that I can think of that is when former United States Senator Jay Rockefeller first decided to run for governor of West Virginia. I think it was in the 1976 campaign. He came out against strip mining, which was a more benign form of what we've all become known as mountaintop removal mining now, where they blast the tops off mountains to remove, you know, a few inches of coal. In his first campaign, he was anti-strip mining, and coal made it plain to Jay Rockefeller very quickly that he would not be elected governor of the state as long as he held, quote, an anti-coal position. And sure enough, Jay Rockefeller lost that election. And sure enough, Jay Rockefeller changed his tune when it came to regulation of the coal industry in his subsequent terms as a public official for the state of West Virginia. So that influence goes all the way down into the local communities, to the boards of education, to the local prosecutor's offices, to the local judges, to all the local elected officials, to all of the law enforcement folks. And And so one has to ask yourself, when you ask, well, why aren't the feds doing more? The first question probably should have been, well, what were the local folks doing? And why is it that we had a federal prosecution based upon a misdemeanor conviction when industrial manslaughter charges could have probably have been put together and led to a significant indictment of all of Massey Management by a local prosecutor who would have been, you know, would have been ambitious enough to take it on? That they didn't speaks loads.
If folks don't know, you know, before the federal jury conviction of Blankenship in December, we were hearing about maybe 31 years he might serve, and that was because of these other counts on which he was not ultimately convicted about lying to regulators. He was only convicted on this misdemeanor count, which is why we're looking at this one-year maximum sentence. But you're getting at why did that not happen, and that has to do with politics. You know, I mean, we think it's a legal question about corporate crime and what legal tools we have. But of course, who the judges are, who's deciding the cases, all of that is very political. So let me then move you on to, you're saying the backbone needs to be at the local level to bring these charges and to allow them to move up. Where do local media come in there? Because it seems to me that public outrage, public concern, and public knowledge are dependent to some extent on reporters getting that story out and making that an urgent story. So what can you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's true enough. I mean, I was a local reporter on a small southern West Virginia newspaper out of college, and I appreciated the strain that one would feel when making decisions about whether or not to write stories about certain local, quote, powerful local officials. I mean, that pressure on local media is palpable. And unless there is an independent media there, the notion of some young prosecutor or any prosecutor standing up and saying, hey, enough is enough and we need to take an independent stand here, it calls for a conviction that, you know, frankly, most average citizens don't possess. And when you weigh that, you know, against the economics of a local economy, a single engine economy, you know, it gets very difficult. A lot of these miners' families who complain about the safety issues associated with operating in a Massey mine, many of those same families were the ones who are complaining about the alleged war on coal, where coal is saying, hey, we're being regulated out of business by the Obama administration. So it becomes a very, very difficult dynamic. I think it's also important to remember, though, and I do want to revisit quickly the nature of the federal charges that he was charged against.
Mm-hmm.
That is not local. That is something that the national politicians could do something about. That's something that the Congress of the United States has had on its desk for some time now and has chosen not to act. And that's a choice not to act as a lack of leadership from Washington representatives from the coal fields. Shelley Capito and Joe Manchin and Mitch McConnell all represent constituents who are laboring in unsafe mine conditions where, that one-year maximum penalty is all that's out there. They can change that anytime that they want. The administration would back that change, and they know that, and they choose not to. And so that one, is very problematic when weighed against what you know is going to be the inertia at the local setting because of the overall power of coal in these communities, what they could be doing with a stroke of a pen, essentially, at the national level to prevent that. Why should it be that it's 30 years to lie to Wall Street, 1 year to conspire to violate the mine laws, safety laws of the United States? And that's a choice that Congress has made.
Exactly. Well, and just analogous to that point about how sort of at a higher level or a federal level, you can say things and do things that are more difficult to do at a local level, I want to talk to national media, you know, and corporate media who present corporate crime as kind of a puzzle, but not an especially urgent one. You know, there's a sense that harm was done. People may have died, thinking about Deepwater Horizon, thinking about, you know, Exxon Valdez, livelihoods destroyed. But the feeling you get is that somehow the harm wasn't done, or it wasn't done in a way that we can adequately address. meaning punish in such a way as to actually serve as a deterrent. And then my beef is that they kind of stop there. You know, it's like, golly, we don't have the tools to respond to a Bhopal. You know, we don't have the tools to respond to the poisoning of a community, the legal tools. And that's the end of the story. You know, I feel like, and what you're saying is, there are things that we have that we could do that could make real change in people's lives if we would push for them.
I mean, you know, there is the power of the pulpit, and there is absolutely no reason that between between responsible leadership and responsible media reporting on that leadership, that a broader message cannot be gotten out. We tend to want to make it too complicated. We tend to want to say that, this is too hard. It's difficult. And I mean, you can have some appreciation for that when you look at all of the resources that were poured into by the federal government to gain a conviction on a misdemeanor count that Blankenship defended with a legal team paid $14, $15 million, and those expenses are still ongoing as he will inevitably appeal to the Fourth Circuit, to defend against that attack, dollars that didn't come out of Blankenship's pocket, by the way, but dollars that will be paid by Alpha Natural Resources, the company that purchased Massey after UBB. It's easy to when the tentacles of the legal system, and we know all about that, 14, 15, 16-year-old fights, believe it or not, are not unusual in the American legal system. And so when the tentacles of the legal system grasp it and hold it and all the complications that come for that, sometimes it's just too easy for the national media or others to say, oh, it's more difficult than it's worth to get to the root of this, when really there are other ways, and that's the pulpit, to get out and get clear communication to people. How hard is it to say to the Congress of the United States, listen, One vote, we go from a one-year criminal penalty on a misdemeanor charge to a multi-year criminal penalty on a felony charge. Why is it that the safety of those coal mines' lives does not matter enough to get that one vote out of you, Congressman?
Right. Well, let me ask you this. CNN's Anderson Cooper was talking about Upper Big Branch, and he said, it's a kind of accident that isn't supposed to happen anymore. I often think that media are most telling in their kind of offhand comments, and that to me was telling. I'm not even let me imagine I know what he thinks he means there, you know, wasn't supposed to happen anymore. But the reality is minor deaths and workplace deaths are not a historical artifact. These are things that happen every day, and part of the media kind of misunderstanding has to do with thinking that they're rare, that they're unusual, and that they're from the past.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. As I said earlier, 53 men at least died under Don Blankenship's watch. You know, we watched Upper Big Branch because 29 died in one spectacularly stupid explosion. But, you know, there are another, 20 miner, or so underground, one or two at a time, dying because of the same management style, the same sense of dollars over men, the same sense of production over safety that accounted for Upper Big Branch. There's a fatalism. I can best think of it in terms of, for me, there's a fatalism in the Appalachian community that drove me crazy and continues to drive me crazy. And that is that, well, some things, basically you just got to put, this is the lot we have in life. This is the hand God dealt us. Sometimes you just got to put up with things and deal with it. That's bull. The laws are on the books. There are inspectors there to enforce the law, and there should be prosecution for the people who disobey the law. End of story. If that becomes the rubric, if that becomes the way in which we conduct ourselves as a society, then hopefully we will get to the point where the Upper Big Branches or the Aracomas or, the mangled arms and twisted limbs and broken backs are things of the past. But put it off as, sometimes I just like to think that, I get concerned that we think that, I can turn off the TV and it goes away. Well, it doesn't go away. It's there. And it's not going to go away until that step after step, step by step, mechanical effort is undertaken to get the law in place and enforce the law, period.
Well, just one more question in a positive direction, because I think Appalachia could be a rich source of news stories. You know, right now the coverage is almost a curiosity. You know, look at these people loving this industry that's killing them. You know, it could be the source of really transformative stories about how do we transition out of fossil fuels? How do we help the people and the communities that have been bound up with these industries, you know? And how do we do it in a human way? I just wonder, if you're talking to journalists, what would you like to see them pursue? What are some stories you would like to see them cover, get into, investigate, that could, you know, provide a different kind of aspect on this story?
In many ways, and this will sound foreign to a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, but in many ways, what Appalachia right now is a microcosm of America. You know, it's always just been more raw down there. It's always been more up against it. And there is a transformational change going on in that region as the world evolves in its energy policies and otherwise, that, you know, really is going to put a culture through a meat grinder, so to speak. And it's the first and best opportunity that we have in the States, it seems to me, to look at what's going on and saying, if we can get beneath and understand and report and effectively describe for the people of this country, as well as the policymakers and decision makers of this country, how these forces are at work, and take it that next level, get past the superficial, get past the stereotype, and try to get to the actual mechanics of what's happening economically and politically down there through this transitional time, it's a roadmap for all of us for the future, because inevitably all of us are going to face that.
We've been speaking with Bruce Stanley. Thank you very much, Bruce Stanley, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Janine, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
With what we know about climate change, should anyone add another child into that future? We'll get two points of view from women who write about it. Then we hear recent science proving extreme rainfall events and extreme drought will continue and get worse as the planet warms. I'm Alex Smith. Buckle up and off we go in this week's Radio EcoShock. When we talk about the conversation, it is usually that far too late talk about sex by parents with their kids who already know all that. Today we are going to relabel the conversation a little bit. It's an inner talk that you have with yourself and maybe a careful dialogue you could share with close friends. And the question is touchy and it's heavy. Knowing the climate is going to be wrecked with huge consequences for humans and for nature, should I bring a child into that world? Or as journalist Madeline Ostrander puts it, How do you decide to have a baby when climate change is remaking life on Earth? That's the title of her latest article in The Nation magazine. Ostrander is also a contributing editor at Yes magazine. Madeline, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
All right. Now, to talk about this, Madeline, I find that I have to bring up my own thoughts and worries. Do you find this subject hits deep with some people?
It does, particularly a certain segment of people, I would say. Of course, people who are in their childbearing years. And, you know, the Yale Project on Climate Communication has divided particularly the American public into kind of six groups in terms of their positions on climate change. And there's a group called the Alarmed, which is about 13% of Americans. And these are the people who take climate change most seriously and know the most about it. And I would say that this conversation is probably hits the hardest for that group of people.
I guess others would simply brush off any mention of climate change or fears for their kids' future. Have you encountered that?
I have encountered that some people really aren't thinking about it. I don't know whether they brush it off or not. It's just that people go about their lives and they're aware of climate change, but it's not real for them. And I think there's a segment of people for whom it is somewhat real and a segment of people for whom it's very real. And for that latter category, I would say that those are the people who are most concerned about how climate change is going to affect their families.
And I noticed early in your article you talk about Paul and Ann Ehrlich's dire predictions in the 1970s. I admire both of them. I've interviewed Paul Ehrlich, but I have to say their future of horror and famine didn't come true, at least not yet. Is that a bad example?
Well, I brought out that example because I think that the conversation that Paul Ehrlich started in the 70s still informs how particularly environmentalists talk about the question of having children. So when people talk about the ethics of having children, and then actually it's not just environmentalists. I mean, people will talk about overpopulation. People will talk about whether or not it's morally right to add another child to the world because of the number of people who are already on the planet. I think that the conversation is shifting a little bit. I think even among population advocates, it's shifting somewhat so that groups like Population Connection, which is the new name of the organization Ehrlich founded, Zero Population Growth, now talk about population in a systemic way, and they talk about human rights and women's rights and bringing health care to people and allowing people to have more choices. And that turns out to solve a large chunk of the question of having too many people. And I think what now we have to wrestle with is how we're actually living on the planet and how the ways that we're living on the planet are contributing to climate change. So my article was an effort to try to shift that conversation to some degree or to acknowledge that there are new pieces of it that we need to talk about.
What are you picturing in the climate changed future that brings you such serious doubts?
Well, as a journalist, I spend a fair bit of time talking with scientists because I write about these issues on a regular basis. And scientists are doing a couple of things. One is that they're more and more using high emission scenarios because that's, as a society, what we've been doing. So scientists are now often looking at the worst case scenarios, the most extreme scenarios for what could happen in the world. They're also getting more and more precise about the kinds of predictions they can make and the ways that they can paint a dire and fairly specific picture of the possible impacts that we could have happen. So, for instance, there was a paper a year ago about mega droughts, droughts lasting several decades across the Southwest and California, that has really serious implications for water shortages in that part of the world, which, of course, has serious implications for agriculture and our ability to feed ourselves. And there was another report by the New York City Panel on Climate Change saying that we could have Superstorm Sandy-style flooding in New York City on a regular basis by 2050. And when you think about 2050, any kid who's born now is just going to be in their 30s. So that means that your life could be marked by these extreme events, and that's a frightening thought for me, and it makes me think about what kind of future could I promise to anyone that I might bring into the world.
Madeline, our parents and grandparents went through the Great Depression and then World War II, where 60 million people died. Is the climate future worse than that?
I guess I would say that I think that the climate crisis is unprecedented in human experience. I think that when you talk to scientists, they will tell you that the kinds of scenarios that we could see would be unprecedented in terms of what humans have been able to deal with and experience. And so if we don't address the issue now, we may not be able to adjust and adapt effectively. We may not be able to thrive and survive. And so I think that it is a different scenario, and it requires different thinking than even a situation in which you're confronting something like major conflict or warfare.
I totally agree. I mean, one of the scariest aspects of climate change is that we have nothing in the past to compare it to. I just spoke to a scientist who said, well, going back 66 million years, we've never had such a fast injection of so much greenhouse gas in such a short time. Nobody knows what's going to happen, and that's another big worry.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, when you're thinking about becoming a parent, you have to make decisions now without knowing what the future is going to look like for you or for your kid, and that's really scary. And to some extent, I mean, that's life. You always have to make decisions not knowing what the future will look like. But I think you don't always have to make decisions with this big shadow of these very troubling scientific predictions hanging over your potential life. And it makes it difficult to think about what is the right thing to do.
I find we tend to make a lot of choices based on our memories. And if you could give me just a minute to share mine, I think that develops into a sort of second question. So beyond the personal decision to have a child, I'm thinking about when I was growing up. I did have children, incidentally, and they revolutionized my life. Now I'm worried about my grandkid. But most Americans and Europeans never experienced what I had as far as nature. I mean, there were empty lots. It was safe to go play in them all day without adults watching. There were woods within walking distance. We went to the lake all summer. I feel like I'm a sibling with nature, but now with people in big cities, millions and millions more in big cities, they're never going to experience that. So my question is, perhaps we could say even without climate change, there are reasons not to have children in this civilization at this time. How do you feel about that?
I think there's been this concern for a long time. When I wrote this article, I did some research and I looked up some of the groups, environmental and population groups of the 70s. And people said, in a way, they said similar things. They said, I don't know whether it's reasonable to bring a child into this world, given everything that's wrong with it. There are also reasons to have children. One thing I think is that it's important to recognize how personal and deep and difficult this choice is for everyone, and to respect the choices that individual families make and give them the space to reflect on these kinds of issues. I think that in the best scenarios, having children gives people a connection to the world and to the future and a sense of a stake in what happens in the world, and a reason to be passionate and get involved and to have love and joy and all of the things that are part of being a human being. There are certainly other ways to do that, and there are many reasons why. Yeah, sure, having a kid might give people pause.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Madeline Ostrander. She's a contributing editor at Yes Magazine and a writer for The Nation. We're talking about the big question, should we bring another child into a world when the future is threatened by climate disruption? There are a few pockets of natural sanity left in all countries, and I'm thinking that women from Beijing to Berlin are asking themselves the question, is this the place to have a baby? It's sort of a where question. I wonder if that figures into this conversation as well.
I mean, I can't really speak for, you know, women around the world, of course. I can talk about how in the article that I wrote, I attended these events that are being organized by a new group that started up out of the East Coast. It's called Conceivable Future. And there are groups of women and men getting together and talking about these very issues that we're talking about on the show. And you will hear in those rooms a very open and compassionate conversation, all different kinds of perspectives about what people feel, you know, how they feel they should make this decision. I heard a mother who was pregnant with her second child and had a toddler at home talk about how she wanted to think about how to teach her kids the kinds of skills that they might need to confront a lot of uncertainty and to confront the difficulties that the world might present them. And she had gone into that process and that decision very thoughtfully. I heard other people say that they weren't sure if they wanted to have children. I heard people wrestling with the decision. I heard people who said that they had actively decided not to. I've also heard from people both before and after writing the article talking about how they made a choice to adopt, or they made a choice to be part of helping raise children in a different way, maybe looking after godchildren or, you know, being involved in raising the next generation in a lot of ways. So I think there's a big diversity in the kinds of choices people can make about this. I think what's new is that people are starting to have this thoughtful conversation about what the future of the world looks like because of climate change and how might that affect their childbearing choices.
Do you think, given that politics is currently almost in a state of denial, at least in one party, about climate change, and the mainstream media just blathers on about everything else, that this conversation is being driven underground, that it's kind of unpolite to mention it at dinner or at parties or at work or at school or anywhere?
It's definitely impolite to try to have this conversation. It's a really difficult conversation. One of the things I reflected about in the article that was in The Nation is that people would sort of whisper this conversation to me for a few years anyway. People I knew would say, I see what's happening with climate change, and it makes me not want to have children. And then maybe they would still have children, but they wouldn't talk about their decision-making process. People would sort of murmur this idea to me, and then they would change the subject quickly because it's an uncomfortable and scary and difficult and very personal thought. I don't know if it's being driven underground by the political context. I think it's just a set of topics that we're not very comfortable talking about. But I think that it's a really important conversation because when you talk about climate change, not in terms of some abstract idea about future generations, but in terms of my own children and what kind of lives are they going to have, it becomes much more deeply personal. And when we start asking those kinds of hard questions, we begin to take the problem more seriously. And my hope is that having that conversation doesn't send it underground, but actually brings things up to the surface that people haven't been talking about yet.
And we know that just a century ago, there really was not much choice for a woman and very little for men either. It was part of human duty to have children. And it's still that way for billions of people in many parts of the world. So it's going to be a while before this becomes a global conversation.
Sure, of course. Even in the United States, there are women who don't have a lot of access to things like contraception and healthcare. And so there are many people who don't have the choice about whether to have children. They have a baby and then they have to think about how they're going to manage. There's ways in which this is a somewhat new situation that we have a substantial number of women in Western and developed countries who do have the ability to make this a choice. And that's part of what makes this conversation and this moment different as well. Millennials in the United States actually have a lower fertility rate than any previous generation in American history. And a lot of that is because of economic reasons. But it signals this shift in the ways that people are making this decision, I think.
And I just read that in the United States today, almost half the babies were born unintended. So a conversation and the decision never took place.
Right. Well, I think part of the conversation as well is not just how do you make this decision, but also once you have children, how do you think about what their future is going to be like and how do you act as a parent? And so those two conversations become bundled together in this discussion about climate change and the future and how are we a part of it?
Madeline, have you seen any poll or survey or research to indicate how many women or what percentage of women are doubting the future enough to reconsider having children?
I looked for that information, but I think that it's not a question that's necessarily on the radar yet of people who do polls. So I think that there's data out there about who's having children, and there's some data about how certain kinds of factors like the economy in particular might be influencing their views about the world. But the environment, I feel like we don't really even have the right language for talking about these questions that we're raising, you know, on this show right now. I think we're just starting this conversation. How does the fate of the world affect your decisions about having children? So no, not yet.
Well, it is the start of a conversation, but millions more people are learning about climate disruption all the time, despite the Koch brothers. And That means that what is a minority now may be the cutting edge. Who knows who could define a whole new movement or a current among human beings? Do you think that can happen?
Yeah, I think that one thing I've noticed since I wrote the article, you know, which was a, I admit, it was, we've talked about impolite conversations. I mean, it's a frightening thing in a way to put out a personal statement like that, and it's not necessarily what I even typically write. But I've had a big response, particularly from young women. I would say probably most of the responses come from women under 35, but even women in their 20s who are wrestling with these questions and felt like they weren't seeing anyone actually talk about them in a public way. So I do think that this is on the cutting edge, and I do think that people who are younger, who grew up with hearing about climate change their whole lives, have a different perspective on it than other people. And I hope that the conversation will keep going and will grow.
Where do men fit into all this?
Well, certainly men do fit into it. I mean, people make decisions as couples. And there were a number of men at, for instance, these events that I talked about where people were getting together and having these conversations about climate change. For some men, it seemed to be still a little bit more of an intellectual conversation than an emotional one. But I think when you're in the position of beginning to actually talk more seriously about having a child, it becomes more emotional and more personal and deeper. So, yeah, I mean, men are definitely part of the conversation. I think as a feminist, I mean, I guess I would say that the ultimate decision about whether you have a child or not should rest with women, but I think men are part of that discussion.
For sure. And I was wondering if you have any suggestions for our listeners on how we could start up these uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah, so one of the organizations that I profiled in my article is a new organization called Conceivable Future, and they are starting these conversations all over the country. They host events in different cities like Los Angeles and Chicago and New York and Providence. So, you know, one thing to do would be to try to connect with them. But I think you don't necessarily need an official format to have a conversation like this. I think just creating some kind of safe space where people feel comfortable talking openly about this issue and know that they're not going to be judged. That was the premise of the events I went to. So I think it's possible to start this conversation, and I think it's important. And I think what I've discovered is that people are actually longing to have this conversation.
Well, we have listeners in small towns in Ohio and Kansas. Are there online resources that they can find?
Sure. The organization that I was just mentioning is called Conceivable Future. And if you Google that, you will find their website. There are other organizations for parents and children. There is a Northwest-based organization that is actually currently in the middle of filing a lawsuit against the federal government because they say that we have not done enough as a nation to safeguard the future of young people. There are lots of resources across the country for parents wanting to educate their children. There's also the organization Population Connection has a project called Population Education, and they have conversations in schools and with children about the issue of population and questions to do with having a child. So that's another resource.
Okay, as we finish up, is there any other parting advice you'd like to leave with us?
I think I would just say that I think that this is a really important conversation to people for people to begin having with one another. I think it's important to think, to be real about how climate change might affect your family, how it might affect the people that you love, how that might influence the decisions that you make. I think it's important to recognize that the predictions for climate change are coming within our lifetimes and could have huge implications on future generations. And I think once we take that seriously, I hope that it starts to transform the whole conversation we have about climate change and make it more possible to think in more personal ways about what it means and how do we make the kinds of changes that are necessary.
We have been talking with Madeline Ostrander. She's a contributing editor at Yes Magazine and contributing writer for The Nation magazine, where she published the seminal article, How Do You Decide to Have a Baby When Climate Change is Remaking Life on Earth? Of course, you can find more, including reader comments, at thenation.com or try the links in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Madeline, thank you so much for getting this conversation going.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Later in this show, scientist Marcus Donat explains his latest paper on extreme precipitation in a hotter world. The old saying about the circus, there's a sucker born every minute. But hundreds of new humans are born every minute as the human population continues to multiply. Many will be Western-style super consumers, the ones who drain resources from all over the world and fill the skies with greenhouse gases. If we can't control that urge, a major climate catastrophe may do it for us. Alicia Graves has one of the answers we need. She calls it green sex, do it for the climate. We'll find out what that means. Alicia has a master's in public health from the University of California. She's co-founded and leads a group called the OASIS Initiative, which stands for Organizing to Advance Solutions in the Sahel. The Sahel is that band of desert countries in North Africa where population is exploding in the face of poverty. But as we'll learn, they are not the big climate problem. Alicia Graves is also a research fellow for Project Drawdown, a group of scientists and other experts working to create a livable climate future. Alicia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Now, you do realize that a lot of people don't even want to hear about this subject at all. Is it because right-wing men, especially in the United States, have poisoned it with religious objections and paranoia? What is the problem? Why are people shying away from talking about population?
That's a very good question. I think what happened is that in the 60s and 70s, as some of the listeners will know, there was a lot of talk about a population explosion. There was a book by Paul Ehrlich that got a lot of attention to the issue. And I guess because his projections didn't pan out as quickly as he expected, people have dismissed it. Of course, there have been coercive population programs in many parts of the world, which have led people to be a bit repulsed by the idea. And actually, in my writing and when I get a chance to speak to people like today, I want to reinforce the fact that it's not so much about population control. It's just meeting women's basic needs to separate sex from childbearing.
Okay, now to hear some environmental groups tell it, all we have to do is install solar energy and drive electric cars, problem solved. Alicia, can we really tackle the climate issue without talking about population?
No, I don't think we can. I think we have to recognize that each one of us has a direct and multiplying effect on all sorts of environmental issues, resource usage for sure, but also emissions and climate. We have to recognize that that's part of the picture. And in doing so, we should also recognize that it doesn't mean telling women what to do. It's about giving us what we want.
And our other instant mental defense, it seems to me, is to tell ourselves it's those billions of peasants over there somewhere who are responsible for population impact. What's wrong with that idea?
Well, like you said in your opening, it's a silly idea because people in the poorest parts of the world, yes, 99% of population growth in this century is happening in less developed countries. So that is a major demographic story. But these are not the people who will be high emitters. We know that U.S. has some of the world's highest emission rates, and it's also true that almost one in two pregnancies in our country and in the U.S. are unintended. By unintended pregnancy, I mean a woman who said they did not intend or mean to get pregnant at that time, or some of them ever again, but they do have a pregnancy. So there's an enormous opportunity to meet women's basic needs for reproductive health services.
You know, when I read that in your article, it kind of blew my mind. I thought, well, look, we're in the age of the birth control pill and all sorts of ways, condoms, whatever. How is it possible that still almost half the babies in the United States are unplanned?
Yeah, it is very surprising. I think something to take into account is that most women in the U.S. want to have, on average, 2 children. So to achieve that, let's just take an average woman, will spend about 5 years either trying to get pregnant or lactating, in which case she's not really eligible to get pregnant. And then she'll spend another 30 years trying to avoid getting pregnant. And so it's a very long time to use consistently and correctly without fail
contraception. And there are technological, you know, malfunctions, there's human error. And so that also needs to be backed up with access to safe abortion, timely and safe abortion, which in light of the current political climate, we have to look very carefully at the views of our potential next president are. I'm scared about the idea of Ted Cruz, for example, because he wants to deny women rights to these basic reproductive health services.
Yep, pretty scary step backwards if that happens. Now, I wish you would take just a little time to explain this formula called IPAT, how it works and why it matters. Tell us about that, please, Alicia.
Thanks, Alex. Yes, I will. I equals P times A times T is a very important equation and pretty straightforward. It was published by Paul Ehrlich and John Holdren, who's the science advisor to the current president. It stands for impact on the environment equals population times affluence times technology. And I think affluence is, in this case, it's our ability to consume. So if we think about it in terms of climate, for example, we know that consumption, especially use of electricity, has, again, a multiplying effect. And T is technology. Now, I've seen another version of this where T, the technology, can actually reduce our impact on the environment. And we're seeing this more and more with climate solutions.
Now, conservatives who we talked about, who are sometimes against women's control over reproduction, also claim to be concerned about spending, about fiscal responsibility. What are the high-cost ways to reduce greenhouse gases versus a low-cost approach?
I can't go too much into the details because I'm focused on two approaches. Let me tell you about these. Family planning is a very low-cost approach. The Guttmacher Institute estimates it's about $6 to $10 per user of family planning per year. So it's a very low-cost approach by allowing women to achieve her family size or avoiding an unintended pregnancy. Another low-cost, very, very high payoff approach is by educating girls. And education, I hope you'll agree, is a basic human right. It's also essential for development. And yet secondary school education, especially for adolescent girls in poor parts of the world, the rates are abysmal. And so this is something that has, in addition to upholding basic rights, allowing women to have more control over her future, it also has a climate payoff. Because by keeping girls in school, it helps delay their marriage and delay their childbearing. It makes it more likely that they'll use family planning in the future and be able to negotiate that with their partner. I mean, there's even evidence to show that women who go to secondary school tend to have better farming outcomes, better crop yields, et cetera. So that's another example. But one other thing I would say in response to your question is, for any listeners who are interested in these different climate solutions, visit the Project Drawdown site. The solutions are more surprising and more diverse than we think, and they're looking at the top 100 solutions that can be scaled up in the coming decades to draw down the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, not just stabilize them just under the 2 degrees Celsius dangerous cutoff that's been identified.
So if I understand your writing, we make a fundamental change in greenhouse gases by reexamining our attitude towards sex. So what do you mean when you say green sex?
Yeah, I thought that was a pretty a clever name for it. But as I said at the beginning, I really just mean allowing women to separate sex from childbearing. And for many of us, we take this for granted, but in parts of the world and in communities in developed countries like the U.S., there are plenty of women who aren't able to do this for various barriers, some of them political and some of them more personal. So I just mean allowing each woman to choose her family size and not let it be something that happens to her.
Well, men are definitely involved because I think in many parts of the world and in the United States, there are men who have been brought up to believe or do believe that the more kids they have, the more manly they are.
Yes, Alex, that is true. And there's the old expression, it takes two to tango. In parts of the world, there's definitely a lot of respect that's garnered on people who have large families. That's something that needs to be recognized. But there are also plenty of men who say that they, you know, either had desire to wait longer before they had a kid or to stop having them altogether, and yet they find themselves with a partner who's pregnant. So I think we should focus on those people who have a need today and make sure that all of those needs are met. Around the world, there are about 220 million women who say they want to stop or space their next pregnancy but aren't using family planning. And so there's a huge opportunity there to reach those women and have tremendous benefits for her personally and her taking control of her life, also her health, her family's health, and of course, like we started with, the climate.
So, Alicia, to be clear, are you telling men and women to stop having children because the climate future is so terrible?
No, I'm not. I have two children myself, and I understand their immense value. And I think actually that they will be the ones to really bring the creativity and the imagination to help solve the climate crisis. I'm telling men and women to recognize that there is a need for family planning. It needs to be put back onto the agenda. We don't have to be afraid to talk about the relationship between population and the environment. We need to look at countries that have had successful voluntary family plannings where family size has fallen very rapidly. And they're around the world. It's Iran, Thailand, Rwanda, for example. These are countries, when it's prioritized, families tend to choose to have fewer children. Couples choose to have smaller families. And so this needs to be on the international agenda.
You know, I think Iran is such a stimulating example because there we have a Muslim country and people have this prototype, preconception that a Muslim country, they won't have family planning. So what do you know what happened in Iran that made it work there?
I know a little bit about it. They realized that population was growing very fast and that it was detrimental to the country's development. And they chose to invest time and money, of course, in making sure that each couple could reach their desired family size. One of the things that they did was put in place mandatory couples counseling before marriage. And I think in the counseling, they talked about many things, but of course, they talked about reproduction, how babies are made, and how to prevent pregnancies in the case that the couple chose to. So if this is something systematic, again, voluntary, backed up with good access to health services, it's not enough to know about how to prevent pregnancy. You need to have the technology, the contraceptives, either modern or there are traditional methods as well in order to do that. It's some people focus so much on getting the information out about avoiding pregnancy, but are afraid to then back that up with good access to contraceptives. You need both, of course.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with American public health expert Alicia Graves about green sex. Alicia, what is the situation in the Sahel where your organization Oasis Initiative works?
Yes, Oasis, as you mentioned, is a project of the University of California, Berkeley. I started it with my colleague Malcolm Potts a few years ago. We are focused on the Sahel region. It's an ecological zone just south of the Sahara Desert. It's a transition zone that stretches across the widest part of Africa. And it really is going to be, it already is, ground zero for climate effects, man-made climate effects on human health. The region has suffered severe droughts and famines since the 70s into the 80s. Even today, at the heart of the region, in a country called Niger, nearly half of children are stunted. They're not growing to their physical or cognitive potential because of malnutrition. We're bringing a multidisciplinary approach to looking at what can we do, what will work, especially for girls and women in this region in order to reach a place of true development. And we have partners in the region, other universities. We're focused on really practical approaches to girls and women's empowerment, especially how to keep girls in secondary school or at least give them some basic life skills. And we're also looking at how to reach women with family planning, which is kind of the last frontier in the field of family planning. It has some of, Niger has the world's highest fertility rates, very large desired family sizes. And yet there are about 1.5 times as many women who want access to contraceptives but aren't using them as there are women who are using them. So even in this very difficult place to work, there are tremendous opportunities to help women meet basic needs for family planning and for taking control of their lives.
And are people there beginning to get cars and motor scooters and things that will emit more greenhouse gases, or are they merely set up in the place where our greenhouse gases are going to have the most impact?
That's a good question. I think most of the least developed countries are really not on a path towards great economic development. Part of the story is because their populations are growing so rapidly that the GDP, the per capita economic growth, is not able to keep up with the population. I think you make a good point. A lot of the lesser developed countries are on a path towards development, and they will be emitting more greenhouse gases in the future. But I think really the story for the least developed countries, unfortunately, is that unless some urgent investment and action is taken in the very near future, they'll be more victims of climate change than they will be contributing to it via, you know, all of these lovely luxuries that most of your listeners are privy to, like motorbikes and cars, electricity at the home, etc. Bill and Melinda Gates, in their most recent annual letter, actually, Bill talks about what a common good energy is, and he makes a very good case for investing in green energy and really approaching it in a much more creative, much more scalable way. Because it's not something, of course, we don't want to deny this to anybody. It's key to our development.
Of course, if drought continues to hit that part of Africa, followed by floods, as it so often is, we may see more climate refugees. We're already seeing a lot of North Africans are headed to Europe as economic refugees, you can call them, but I would call some of them climate refugees. That'll change the picture because then they'll want to live like Europeans.
Yes, the refugees from Syria last summer, which of course is still continuing, but it was in the news a lot last summer, it got a lot of attention. And what people need to know is that this is just sort of the tip of the iceberg. The UN projects that about 60 million people will move out of the desertified areas, the places in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, that are becoming more desert-like because it's harder to live there. About 60 million people moving out of those regions by 2020, which is a huge number. It doesn't mean that all of them are going to Europe. They could be relocating in other parts of sub-Saharan Africa. But these are very vulnerable populations that need our attention and really forethought. This is just at the cusp, and there are some things that can be done now, like heavy, heavy investments in adolescent girls' education, voluntary family planning, and, of course, planning for migration. So, yeah, migration is a big part of the story.
Now, we have the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We had the recent Paris climate talks. Do these international bodies take the population angle seriously, or are they afraid to talk about it?
Alex, that's a very good question, and I don't know the answer. There's a great report it's the Climate and Health report from the last series of IPCC reports, and it recognizes reproductive health services, including modern family planning, as having the potential for climate mitigation to reduce carbon emissions. It talks about co-benefits for human health and the climate. So there are some people in these institutions that definitely do recognize it, but oftentimes I read reports that really focus on how rapid population growth is a challenge. There is a recent World Bank report about climate impact amongst poor families in poor parts of the world, and they cited rapid population growth, I think, 10 times as a contributing factor. But then in 70 pages of recommendations, they didn't go on to recommend investment in voluntary family planning. So some people either don't understand the relationship between population and environment, but I think more often they don't recognize that something can be done that upholds women's basic human rights and has positive effects on the environment.
And you've linked to a paper titled Reproduction and the Carbon Legacies of Individuals. It's by Paul Murtaugh and Michael Schlacks. What does that contribute to this conversation?
Oh, that's a very interesting analysis that looks at, yes, as you say, the carbon legacy, the effects, the carbon effects of each child that a couple has. And I forget exactly how they do their analysis, but of course, each child has his or her own carbon footprint, but then they have the likelihood that they will again have a child. So it's like a multi-generational type analysis to look at the carbon effects. And the takeaway is that having an additional child will have, let me put this positively because it is a positive story, that averting an unintended pregnancy will have greater benefits for reducing greenhouse gases than all of the other things that we can do combined. This is in the case of high-consuming couples. Averting an unintended pregnancy will have greater benefits than buying a Prius and, going solar electricity for the house, et cetera. So I think it's a really good paper. I'm glad you brought that up.
So wrapping this up for our listeners, I'm sure we're all wondering, how do we approach this? How do we talk to other people about this subject? Do you have any ideas for conversation starters?
I think that we don't have to be afraid about making the connections between population and the environment. You can be concerned about the environment and population's effects on it, and at the same time want to uphold a woman's rights to have a family. Because we have about 40 years of data from around the world showing that when governments prioritize and invest in voluntary family planning, family size falls. That's the conversation opener. We need to get population back on the world agenda.
Do you have any websites, a Facebook page or a Twitter feed that you'd like to pass on to our listeners?
Yes, I would. Please look at our website, oasisinitiative.berkeley.edu. We are looking for partners, and we are also have a Friends of the Sahel Network, which is a button you can click if you would like to join and become one of our friends who's interested in the Sahel region of Africa.
We've been speaking with public health expert Alicia Graves about a solution for climate change where each of us does have some power, and that's giving women the choice on reproduction and producing fewer high-carbon consumers. As always, listeners, you can find those links just mentioned and more in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Alicia, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Alex.
Let's talk about extreme precipitation events. News about record rains or sometimes snow has become so frequent I could do a show on it every week. Just recently, a half dozen people died in floods in Louisiana. Parts of Brazil were hit with half their average monthly rainfall in just one day. In the desert, the United Arab Emirates just recorded their highest single-day rainfall ever, 50 times normal for March. New research says this is only going to get worse as the world warms, but with an unexpected twist, for me at least. A letter published in the journal Nature Climate Change is titled More Extreme Precipitation in the World's Dry and Wet Regions. In Sydney, Australia, we've reached the lead author, Marcus G. Donat, a research fellow at the Climate Change Research Institute at the University of New South Wales. Marcus, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, hi.
Good. Well, let's start here. How do we define extreme precipitation?
Oh, there's certainly many ways to define extreme precipitation. It really depends on what you're interested in. Yeah, if it's a prolonged rain event that brings you extreme rainfall over several days, or in many cases, it's really just the very short and intense storms that bring large amounts of rain just in a few hours. What we did in this study was considering extreme rain as the annual maximum of the rainfall amounts that falls within one day. So basically, we had daily recordings from many parts of the world, and basically, we're just choosing the annual maximum of all of these annual values. And this measure is for us a good compromise between capturing relevant extremes but also having a reasonable global coverage, because these global totals of rainfall are a temporary aggregation that is observed in many and also reported from many parts of the world. So this helped us to increase the global coverage.
So the type of events that I just described as recent news, would that fit into the kind of research you're doing?
Absolutely, yes. So basically this measure of daily totals and looking into the annual maxima of these daily totals totally would still capture these kind of events that are related to intense storms, mainly of convective nature, that were related to those extreme rainfall events, for example.
For years, Marcus, scientists have told us as global warming proceeds, the dry places will get drier and the wet regions will get wetter. Is that really what you found?
This is actually not what we found, but we were not the first to basically challenge this wet get wetter, dry get drier which, theory, which has become kind of a paradigm. But this has also to do with the way the wet and the dry regions are defined, or what parts of the world you're considering. So the dry get drier, wet get wetter theory basically was based on a study by Held and Zonen in 2006, who analyzed climate model experiments and who considered basically the entire globe, including land and ocean. And in these climate model experiments, they basically found that the geographical latitudes that are usually dry would become drier in a warmer climate, and the latitudes that are usually wet would become wetter. But so this also depends on basically this very simplified spatial aggregation by just looking into certain latitude bands. There have been a number of studies recently looking into the whole pattern of precipitation changes more detailed, and they actually found, on the one hand, if you look into the different regions in a more geographical sense, with more geographical detail rather than just the latitude, then the picture might look different. And more importantly also, if you're only looking at precipitation over land, then this dry get drier, wet get wetter theory does not hold, even in the climate model.
If the dry places on Earth get more rainfall, isn't that good news?
In part. In terms of water balances, it is certainly better than receiving even less rainfall. However, as these increases are related to increasing global temperatures in terms of global warming, they go also in hand with in higher temperatures. And so if you're thinking about water availability, it's a bit more complex than just saying there is more rain, because at the same time, there might also be more evaporation as the climate becomes warmer. And so the balance between the evaporation and the increased rainfall, and so there might not be more water available, for example, for growing plants. At the same time, what we focused on with this study was not only looking into the changes of the total precipitation, but also extending the whole analysis to rainfall extremes, the kind of extremes we talked about earlier, yeah, basically the maxima of the daily rainfall amounts. And here we see that these extremes show very robust increases between the observations and the climate models with climate warming, because these rain events usually are storms that bring a lot of water just in a very short time period of a day or less. This then, it's a significant result in terms of flooding and related impacts like soil erosion, for example.
Yes, it can cause a lot of economic damage and damage to people's lives when their houses flood, their business flood, the road floods out, and so on. So your study is saying that we can expect more of that, more damage, as the climate warms.
Exactly. So basically, as the climate warms, the atmosphere can hold more water. So there's in physics a relationship, it's called the Clausius-Clapeyron relationship, and this defines what's the saturation water pressure of water in the atmosphere, and it tells us that with every degree of higher air temperatures, the air can hold about 6 to 7% more water vapor. And so if this increased amount of water vapor in atmosphere all rains out at the same time, then this would be related to stronger rainfall extremes and the related impacts that you were just talking about, correct?
Okay, now a senior, say somebody who's 60 years old, is looking back and they think they never saw those kind of rainfall events. I'm always hearing this on the news, well, I never saw rain like this before. Is that true?
Well, let's say at any individual location, it is really hard to measure these things, to really see if it's a record or not. This is related to several factors. On the one hand, precipitation, in particular extreme precipitation time series, are very variable in time. So we also call it very noisy in time. So this means that they show a lot of fluctuation between different years. For example, there are years that are very wet. There are other years that are very dry. And so if looking at any really just individual location, it is very hard to actually find statistically robust, statistically significant trends in these very noisy time series. What we have to do to basically get a clearer picture of the signal of the actual change compared to the noise is, for example, we would have to aggregate spatially by basically, for example, calculating a spatial average over a slightly larger region rather than just looking at one station time series. And this averaging reduces the noise, reduces the strong variability that is apparent in the individual time series, and then really helps us to more clearly actually see the signal, which is the signal which in this case is then the long-term trend in the extreme precipitation, for example. So if somebody experiences a record rainfall at a specific location, and let's say an old person, as you were referring to, has never seen this before, this might in fact be true for this location and also in the memory of this person. But doing such analysis globally over larger regions where all the different time series have a lot of noise, it's a statement that's really hard to prove statistically.
Going forward, what does this study suggest will be happening by 2050 or 2100? Will records continue to fall so much that we just expect rains to become heavier all the time?
Yeah, exactly. So actually in this study, we also looked into future climate projections. So one part of the study really looked into the past 60 years where we could compare observations to what the climate models were doing. And we found that actually with the way we analyzed the data here, there's a high robustness, there's a really strong agreement between what we're observing and what the models are doing. So this really gives us confidence that the models actually are doing a pretty good job in simulating this kind of precipitation extremes we're looking at here. And so in the second step, we then also looked into the future simulations, future projections of the climate, for which obviously we don't have observations, but the climate models are a useful tool to look into the future. And these simulations actually suggested the tendencies that we've observed for the past 60 years will continue over the next century. So basically we looked until the end of the 21st century, and so we see clear continuing increases in the precipitation extremes in these dry and also in the wet regions in the future projections of the climate models. And we then also tried to understand these increases a bit more detailed, because they show actually a wide range of increases, and maybe a wider range than we would be happy with giving as an indication, for example, to stakeholders. At the same time, the different future projections, as they were, example, also presented in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment reports. And here we also see that actually the increase in global temperatures shows quite a range between the different models. Yeah, for example, it might increase between 3 and 6 degrees globally for a given scenario. And so what we tried also in this study was to relate basically the precipitation response to the global climate response. And here we also found a very strong relationship that actually the spread, the uncertainty in future rainfall simulations, future rainfall projections, is strongly related to the amount of global warming to this particular model. So basically a model that shows a stronger global warming also shows a stronger precipitation response, in particular in the drier regions, whereas a model that shows less warming in response to increased greenhouse gases also shows a slightly weaker response in these extreme precipitation measures. So that we can really formulate this relationship that there's basically this dependence of precipitation changes on global temperature changes.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Marcus Donat from the University of New South Wales in Australia. I'm wondering, do extreme rainfalls occur more in certain regions? For example, will they hit the developing world harder than Europe or North America?
Well, this is a question that's still hard to answer for us. So what we knew already before the study is that on a global average, we're seeing more extreme rainfall and also more intense extreme rainfall. But the spatial patterns of how it's exactly changing in a specific region still were quite uncertain, because there's some disagreement also between different observational data sets and in particular also between the observations and the climate models. So to get closer to regional information, we took a slightly different approach in this study. We did not, for example, look into a specific country in, for example, Africa, and and compared it to changes, for example, in the U.S. to have this comparison between developed and undeveloped world. What we did here was really looking into all the regions globally that are dry and all the regions globally that are wet, and analyzing the changes in these as an average over these dry regions and over these wet regions. But this means that, for example, we're putting together the changes in, say, North Africa and the Sahara with the Australian desert regions, but also with the dry regions in Southwest North America. This approach helped us to get this really consistent results, but still it is possible that in individual locations that are contributing to this larger average, there may be some different changes. So unfortunately, we are not yet really able to tell if a specific country, a specific region will be more strongly affected than others.
Well, as we wrap up, I want to ask you, are you personally concerned about our future if climate change goes further or faster than the IPCC has forecast?
I am certainly concerned in a sense that this will change the planet we are living on. This basically also calls for the responsibility of all of us, but particularly of the politics, to find solutions to help people who may not be able to live in the place where they lived before. This is probably the major impact. I don't think that we have to talk about horror scenarios that the Earth will basically not longer be a livable place, or that humans may even get extinct or something like this. It is more really that maybe some regions are no longer good regions to live in terms of course, we're talking on the one hand about sea level rise, so some land areas may just disappear. But we're also talking about other changes, such as there might be still areas where drought increases, and it may not be possible to grow crops and to basically have a living there. And so there must be solutions just to settle those people elsewhere. In addition, of course, there's impacts to ecosystems. There might be extinctions to certain plant and animal species. And these are all just losses that are not reversible and that make me pessimistic. But the whole global warming science and the impacts it has on so many aspects of the world is a very complex thing, and there's many aspects to worry about. But I also think that our life and our society will continue. We just have to be prepared that it might be differently, and that we will have to find solutions for several impacts that are related to this warming.
Okay. From the University of New South Wales Climate Change Research Center and the ARC Center of Excellence for Climate Systems Science, we've been speaking with Marcus G. Donat. He's the lead author of a research letter just published in the journal Nature Climate Change. It's titled More Extreme Precipitation in the World's Dry and Wet Regions. Marcus, thank you for spending time with us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
We're out of time, in this radio show at least. Join me every week for Radio EcoShock and get all the links for this program and the weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
This is Steve Fowle, editor of the New Hampshire Gazette, the nation's oldest newspaper, based in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, warning you to brace yourself for this upcoming reading of our latest fortnightly rant.
From April 1st, 2016, Sympathy for the Devils. It may just be the Stockholm Syndrome, but we're starting to feel almost sorry for the muckety-mucks who run, or thought they were running, the Republican Party. Early in March, with their options dwindling, a passel of panicked poobahs, desperate to thwart Trump's ambitions, boarded a squadron of private jets and flew to an emergency skull session at exclusive Sea Island, Georgia. The tenor of the discussion has, shall we say, devolved since then. Ben Carson came straight out and said he was endorsing Donald Trump because Trump had offered him a position in his administration. Neither Trump nor Carson seemed to know or care that any such quid pro quo is illegal and carries a penalty of 2 years in the pokey. Senator Lindsey Graham then endorsed Ted Cruz, the last viable non-Trump and the most loathed senator since Joseph McCarthy, whom he uncannily resembles. Graham, who had previously said, if Cruz was murdered on the floor of the Senate, no one in that body would vote to convict his assassin, called the Alberta-born senator his 15th choice. So far, so weird. Then things took a turn for the sordid. Trump and Cruz began tussling over the relative hotness of their would-be first ladies. Wealthy Texas lobbyist Andrea McWilliams, in a move whose etiquette seems rather dubious, used the recent death of former First Lady Nancy Reagan as her cue to say on television that it was critically important for voters to remember that Melania Trump would be the first third wife to become First Lady and the first First Lady that has ever posed nude. Trump responded with a threat to spill the beans about Cruz's wife Heidi. This was generally taken to be a reference to a bout of severe depression, which would be perfectly understandable in anyone married to Ted Cruz. At this point, as Republicans prepared to swallow their pride, along with a few shots of Pepto-Bismol, and embrace Ted Cruz to save themselves from Trump, and in a blatant defiance of the laws of gravitas, things plummeted even further downhill. The National Enquirer reported that Cruz had had at least 5 extramarital affairs. The March 26th New York Post carried a front-page headline saying, Dirty Tricks, Cruz Trump in Cuban Mistress Crisis. Amidst this roiling turmoil, the 2016 Republican National Convention looms. In his inimitable fashion, Trump has said that he ought to get the nomination even if he falls short of the required delegates. If he does not, there could be riots. He's not calling for riots, mind you. They may just happen. As in, nice arena you've got here. Be a shame if anything happened to it. As for my campaign manager, who will be appearing in court on May 4th to answer charges of simple battery against a reporter, that's no big deal. He just hired Kendall Coffey, a great lawyer. Sure, he lost his job as a U.S. attorney because he bit a stripper once, but that kind of thing could happen to anybody. As we said, we started to feel almost sorry for this bunch. Then we remembered that the global economy is organized around policies they have promulgated. Thanks to these policies, Lamborghini found a market for a $2 million, 770-horsepower car capable of exceeding the speed limit on U.S. interstate highways by 147 miles per hour. Those policies, though, provide no incentive for anyone to produce vaccines for so-called orphan diseases. To the contrary, under policies supported by virtually all Republicans, industrialized meat producers, to increase their profits, not only can feed animals massive quantities of antibiotics, thus hastening the resurgence of untreatable diseases, but they also can deduct the cost as a business expense. Likewise, Republicans protect the right of fossil fuel corporations to protect market share by subsidizing fake science, denying that fossil fuels are rendering the planet uninhabitable by humans. Today is April Fool's Day. Looks like the joke's on us.
This is Steve Fowle, editor of the New Hampshire Gazette, and I approve this reading of the latest fortnightly rant to the listeners of Making Waves. To find out more about the New Hampshire Gazette, including subscription info, see www.nhgazette.com. That's Gazette with one Z and two T's. Thank you.
the chairwoman of Anukbah in Chicago and the National Solidarity Officer of Anukbah in USA. Anukbayan is a comprehensive national democratic organization for the people's struggle in the Philippines. She is also a youth president of the Youth of Iglesia Filipina Independiente, the youth lay organization of the Philippine Independent Church Diocese of Eastern USA and Eastern Canada, a church born out of the Philippine Revolution of 1896. She is also a member of the Coordinating Committee for International League of People's Struggle, ILPS USA chapter. Lorena is someone who continues to mold herself into an activist for the people, and I have seen that day to day working with her as my kasama. So I'd like to welcome Lorena to the stage.
Good evening, everyone. Warm and militant greetings to everyone here fighting for a just world, especially to our powerful sisters who has inspired us in their struggle that resonates in us. So thank you very much for sharing your stories. Today, we are witnessing worsening attacks against our communities, from attacks on students, parents, and teachers with the commodification of education, the violent separation of families through mass deportation, to the outright murder and incarceration of our Black sisters and brothers by an institution that claims to protect and serve. Anti-people policies is the face of neoliberalism in the belly of the beast, which is right here. These policies exacerbate the worsening conditions of women who are already exploited in every aspect of our daily lives. Tell me of a woman who has never experienced financial inequality with their male counterparts, which was already brought up earlier. Tell me of a woman who has had their right to reproductive services and the right to their bodies, their own bodies, being stripped away. Tell me of a woman who has never felt fear when one out of three women experience harassment and sexual violence every day. And this oppression, this fear, is real every single day in our lives, and it is being normalized. And that in itself is injustice, when you feel that fear is something normal that you have to live through every day. Until when are we going to allow this system to exploit, oppress, and even murder our sisters and our people in the name of super profit? There needs to be a radical shift in our consciousness. As Monique Wilson, the Filipina National Democratic Activist, said, once our consciousness has been awakened, there is no other way but to go forward. To create change, not superficial change or bandage solutions, but systematic change. It is this radical shift of consciousness that pushes us to put ourselves, our bodies, our ideas, our creativity, and our talents on the line to be able to contribute to the change we want to see. And this is exactly what these wonderful and powerful women serving our communities have done. And it is such a great honor to be able to speak after y'all. Thank you so much for being here. And this is all you. And it is the same imperialist agenda that has caused the occupation, colonization, and imperialist plunder and genocide in Palestine, in Honduras, in Mexico, in the Philippines, and other nations in the world. Neoliberalism caused the destruction of land and human labor in the name of, again, super profit. Not for the people. In the Philippines, I don't know if you know much about it. It's like an archipelagic island in the southern, north, southeastern part of the world. The Philippines is rich in natural resources. It is the sixth richest deposit of chromite, fifth richest in nickel, fourth in copper, and third in gold. But despite all these riches, my people could not taste this wealth, as the majority of the people, my people, live in poverty. As multinational corporations, in cooperation with the corrupt government, continue to steal our land, our resources, and push my people to become cheap labor force working in slave-like conditions in this country. Just like here in the U.S., if you see a lot of Filipinos in nursing homes, in caregiving homes, anywhere taking care of people, but not being able to take care of themselves. One of the most affected people in the Philippines are the Lumas, or indigenous tribes in the southern Philippines, where 233 documentations of human rights violations have been documented. against ILLUMA children. 9 out of 10 kids cannot even access education. 40,000, more than 40,000 people as of September 2015 were forcibly displaced from their ancestral domain because of militarization we are funding. $60 million of our taxpayer money this year is going to go into military aid. It's going to go to killing my people instead of serving our communities here for education, for healthcare. And 150-plus indigenous peoples, environmentalists, and human rights activists have been killed. If you want to learn more, shout out to our table. This is a situationer on the issue in the Philippines. Tonight I would like to share the struggle and resistance of indigenous women in Mindanao. And I would like to share this video.
Sikan na ako no kay angay ka igtabang yung kanami na sinangar pagdayon ko pagtabang kanami. So kanami sa ini warad mo piyan pagkupo na so terbaho na kung to yan og siwal kawawi nagmangon to terbaho na kan nagat na maramara si kano kag pangimatay sa ayak.
Ima ko pa ngayon o kanang ripon man ang takon yung anak ko. Anak siya nga, wala man ko naging anak sa emwa. Anak ko manong, anak ko ginan ko ni mo ganina o wala man takon na rilok sa inyo ako ayo. Kung wala ko naman ang pangalipan, anak ko.
Kani ma'am, ang unsa man ang inyong mga babae.
Alright, so that is, I would rather they speak about the struggle and for you to hear it from them than me share it to you. Another opportunity to hear them speak, they will be coming to the U.S. to go to the White House to demand that those military aid, this funding that's supposed to serve the people there, that's killing our people, they're demanding that that funding not be used for the Philippines. And we here, our job here in the U.S. is to demand that those funding goes to us, to services that will support our communities. They will be coming here. They will be in Chicago May 2nd and 3rd, and I really hope that you would come, hear their story, hear them speak, and support the struggle. We would like to also invite people. On this summer, we will be having an international solidarity mission, a fact-finding mission towards the militarized communities in the Philippines. If you would like to learn more, please go to our table where there's amazing references from FRSO, Nurses United, Anak Bayan, and the Rasmia Defense Committee. We'd like to ask for your support. Our struggle is one and the same, and a woman's place is in the struggle. As you saw earlier, you are never too young or too old to fight for justice, to fight for your rights. Let's just like women here and everyone that's in this room. The people's liberation is not complete without the liberation of women, and we cannot separate the liberation of women from the fight for our people's genuine liberation. So, like the chant that was being done earlier. When women's rights are under attack, what do we do? Stand up, fight back. When people's rights are under attack, what do we do?
Stand up, fight back.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist Ted Snyder, who examines hidden forces that may be behind Brazil's current political crisis that threatens to bring down the nation's leftist Workers' Party government. Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program, who talks about how community solar programs can deliver the benefits of non-polluting cheap solar energy to all income groups. And author and activist Harvey Wasserman, who explains why he's concerned that the results of the 2016 U.S. election could be open to manipulation and outright theft. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Russian President Vladimir Putin boycotted the Nuclear Security Summit, a gathering of 50 world leaders meeting to tackle nuclear proliferation. The Russian leader snubbed this year's summit for what he said was a lack of mutual cooperation. However, the recent bombings in Brussels added a new sense of urgency to prevent extremist groups like ISIS from getting access to radioactive materials to make a dirty bomb. In Putin's absence, the focus turned to East Asia, as the U.S. and China agreed to press for new sanctions against North Korea in response to a recent nuclear test by the secretive Northeast Asian nation. During a side meeting at the summit, President Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping agreed on a new consensus to confront North Korea's nuclear ambitions. Nuclear proliferation in East Asia has become an issue on the presidential campaign trail since GOP candidate Donald Trump suggested that Japan and South Korea should acquire nuclear weapons as a counterweight to North Korea. This would reverse decades of U.S. policy determined to limit the spread of nuclear weapons in Asia. Although Barack Obama began his presidency by pledging to reduce the dangerous role of nuclear weapons in the world, the Nobel Peace Prize winner is ending his time in office by ordering the modernization of the U.S. nuclear arsenal over the next 3 decades at an estimated cost of nearly $1 trillion. Conservatives who control the Arizona state legislature are moving to dismantle the state's Clean Election Campaign Finance Law enacted in the late 1990s. The move could unleash a new wave of secret dark money in campaigns led by the conservative billionaire Koch brothers. Republican Secretary of State Michelle Reagan, who is leading the drive to gut the Clean Elections Commission, won her last election with an 11th-hour injection of dark money from a conservative group that paid for a blitz of TV ads against her Democratic Party opponent. The bill would remove enforcement of Arizona's campaign disclosure rules from the Citizens Clean Elections Commission and give it to the Federal Internal Revenue Service. Robert McGuire of the Center for Responsive Politics told the American Prospect magazine, "The IRS is about as good at effective, timely oversight over politically motivated nonprofits as a sea cucumber is at chess. Federal agency enforcement lags far behind elections," explains McGuire, meaning that even when agencies do go after secret spenders, the candidates who benefited have often already finished at least one term in office. But lately, the IRS has essentially signaled that anything goes, granting favorable tax-exempt status to even such blatantly political groups as Crossroads GPS, masterminded by GOP operative Karl Rove, and a conservative Arizona group known as Americans for Responsible Leadership. Yale student Alex Jang is outraged at the sight of a stained glass window showing a slave kneeling before John Calhoun in one of the Ivy League University's residential colleges. Calhoun, a Yale graduate and a former U.S. vice president, once boasted slavery was a positive good. Now, Yale students are campaigning to change the name of Calhoun College to honor Roosevelt Rosie Thompson, an African-American Rhodes Scholar and student activist who died in a car accident in his senior year. Across America, students inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement are working to redefine civil rights activism beyond diversity and inclusion. Students are mobilizing to dramatically increase the number of African-American students and faculty on campus. The Christian Science Monitor observes that a new generation of activists has grown up in the age of Obama, America's first black president, and with the reality that mass incarceration has imprisoned a generation of black and Latino men. Many minority students are demanding that their own histories in the U.S. be acknowledged. Student groups are demanding more ethnic studies scholars, as well as curriculum requirements that all students become aware of what happened to their ancestors in America, and a more sophisticated understanding of how these histories affect the reality of their experiences today. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
For months now, Brazil has been embroiled in a swirling corruption scandal known as Lava Jato, or car wash, involving the state oil company Petrobras, construction contractors, the ruling Workers' Party, and opposition politicians. As the nation prepares for this summer's Olympic Games, Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff has been dogged by a slumping economy and an impeachment drive by conservative opponents who charged that she had cooked the books in the run-up to the 2014 presidential election. Prosecutors have attempted to implicate popular two-term president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, known as Lula. In mid-March, prosecutors questioned Lula on allegations of money laundering involving a vacation home and a construction company, which the former president denied. When his successor, President Rousseff, sought to appoint Lula as her chief of staff, the move was seen by opponents as a way to shield Lula from possible future prosecution. A justice on Brazil's Supreme Court responded by blocking the appointment, which Lula has now appealed. Amid large anti-government and pro-government street protests, President Rousseff has charged that the allegations against her are false and part of a coup attempt to remove her from office, orchestrated by her political enemies. Your reporter spoke with Canadian journalist Ted Snyder, who discusses his recent article titled A Silent Coup for Brazil, which examines the current crisis in Brazil against the backdrop of the U.S. exercise of soft power in the post-Cold War era to destabilize and topple governments it viewed as adversaries in Eastern Europe and Latin America.
So what's going on in Brazil right now has the appearance of democracy in action, has the appearance of massive street protests against Dilma Rousseff's PT government, and it has the appearance of a noble judicial effort to bring members of the government up on corruption charges. So the way it's being presented in the North American media and in most of Brazil's media is sort of this model of mass democracy expressing itself in a really noble way. So you're getting impeachment attempts against Dilma Rousseff. You're getting former President Lula da Silva being held for questioning. You're getting people arrested for kickbacks and bribery. But what's scary about it is that it fits a pattern that's been occurring in Latin America but elsewhere in the world since the beginning of the Obama administration, since 2009, where things that look like democratic moves to improve government are actually coups that look like democracy. These are very different from the first stage of Latin American coups that, you know, that involved the Marines and guns, and then the second stage of coups that began in 1954 with the CIA covert coup in Guatemala. The pattern that strikes me in the last few years is that these coups have gone even deeper into the shadows, where they don't look like coups at all. They actually look like democracy. I raised the question in my article of whether this appearance of democracy isn't just in fact part of this pattern of what I perceive to be a new style of coup.
I think to the casual reader of the U.S. corporate press, they would look at the stories written and the TV coverage of what's going on in Brazil and believe that there is a lot of evidence that would suggest the Workers' Party leadership has been corrupted and deserve to be held to account.
Yep.
How do you counter the notion that this is some kind of mass democratic rejection of the Workers' Party for this apparent corruption and not something more nefarious like an opposition party-led coup d'etat?
Yeah. So, Scott, I think there's two things or two or three things to be said to that. And the first is this thing called Lava Jato, this car wash or corruption cleaning. I think it did start as a sort of noble judiciary and police action against real corruption in the government. So I don't want to pretend that there's no corruption in Brazilian government or in the Workers' Party of the PT. There certainly is corruption. But I think that two things need to be said about that. The first is the specific charges brought up against the current president and the former president actually have nothing to do with Lava Jato, and they have nothing to do with corruption. The impeachment charge against Dilma Rousseff is that she used borrowed money to make it look like Brazil's budget was still on track. This is not an impeachable offense. It's not even an illegal offense. It's a common practice. So they've found no corruption charges against Dilma herself. So the attempt to impeach the president is actually outside of Lava Jato. It's outside of the corruption charges. Similarly, with Lula da Silva, the charges that have been brought against Lula are that he owns some beachside property that he claims not to own, and that he accepted money from corporations for giving speeches. Now, the two things we said about that is that neither one is illegal. Neither one's an impeachable offense. And more importantly, they both occurred after he was president. So although there's certainly corruption in the PT, the charges against the current and former presidents have nothing to do with the corruption. More importantly, the corruption was present in both parties. It was present in the PT and probably to a greater extent in the right-wing opposition, the PSDB. So it started off as finding dirt in both parties. But what happened is the car wash got carjacked, and it got transformed from finding corruption in both parties to shielding the PSDB and only really going after corruption in the PT.
So what is the role of Washington here in supporting what you contend is really a coup d'etat that is in part supported by external forces?
Yeah. Scott, I think that's the ultimate question. I think there are indications that there could be U.S. involvement, but I don't think that those indications have been proven yet. The reason that I raised the question in the article I'm suspicious of is that the other countries that fit this pattern have been shown to have U.S. involvement. The two coups that happened first in South America this way were Honduras, when President Manuel Zelaya was taken out in a coup, in what looked like a constitutional move, and you had a constitutional coup. Shortly after that, in Paraguay, the same thing happened, also in Latin America, where the right-wing opposition seized power in the legislature, where they took advantage of a skirmish over disputed land that left about a dozen people dead. They unfairly blamed it on the left-wing president, Fernando Lugo. We know that the Americans knew about both of these coups because leaked documents, WikiLeaks documents and others show it. The pattern in Brazil is similar, so one wonders if it's backed by the states, and certainly there's that suspicion. So I don't think there's proof yet, but I think the pattern demands that we ask the question.
That was Canadian-based journalist Ted Snyder, who writes about the patterns in U.S. foreign policy and history. Find links to Snyder's recent article titled A Silent Coup for Brazil by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Solar power is booming across the United States, in part because the cost of solar panels has plummeted in recent years. The solar industry forecasts that roughly 20,000 megawatts of solar capacity will come online over the next 2 years, doubling the country's existing solar capacity, which today only provides a tiny fraction of the nation's overall energy mix. Residential rooftop solar panels that produce electricity are one of the fastest-growing sectors of the solar boom. But more than three-quarters of America's homes are not suitable for solar installation for a variety of reasons. However, these homes can benefit from what's called community solar, in which solar arrays are built in a separate location, and residents can buy into the system to receive electricity. But community solar is not available in every state, mostly due to opposition from the electric utility industry. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tyson Slocum, director of the energy program at Public Citizen. Here he explains how solar installations work, why utilities often oppose these systems, and how community solar programs that target the participation of low-income groups can establish a business model that will allow the greatest number of people to benefit from solar energy.
There is no question that when you've got more and more customers generating their own electricity, either from their own solar panels that they own or generating power through a community solar program, that is in opposition to the financial interests of the incumbent distributional utility, because a utility earns money based on the sales of electrons to its customers. And if a larger proportion of its customers are not buying those electrons from the utility anymore, or in some cases, actually requiring the utility to buy electrons from them, in the case of a successful rooftop solar facility that is producing electrons in excess of what the household uses in electric power. So there is no question that the nature of the electric utility business model that's existed since the 1880s when Thomas Edison invented the first centralized power plant in New York City, we have to recognize that technology in the form of cost-effective rooftop solar requires dramatic changes in the corporate and business structure of electric utilities.
Tyson Slocum, how are solar systems funded? How are the different ways they are funded, and who benefits?
The primary way that rooftop solar owners can get compensated for their costs associated with buying and installing and operating these systems is through various tax subsidies. At the federal level, there's an investment tax credit that is set to phase out and expire over the next 5 years. And that simply allows you to take a tax credit based on the value of the cost of the solar system that you're installing on your rooftop. Depending upon the state or municipality, a number of different state and local tax incentives. But the biggest incentive that is featured in more than 30 states is something called net metering. And all net metering says is that if I am producing more electrons from my rooftop solar system than I am using in my household, that every month I can get credit on my electric bill for the excess electricity that my solar panels sold into the grid. But the amount of the payment that is provided to the solar owner is based upon the retail price of electricity. Now, if you've got 1% of households in a utility service area that are getting paid by other non-solar customers, that's not a big deal. But if 5% or 10% or 20% of all of a utility's customers are producing their own electricity from rooftop solar and are getting paid by customers that don't have rooftop solar, it does create an equity issue where those that have the financial or the technical capability to generate their own power from rooftop solar, they are going to see dramatically lower electric bills. And those customers that cannot afford access to rooftop solar or don't live in a building where it's possible because they live in a multifamily apartment building, they don't own their building because they rent, or if the building is just not in a suitable sunny place because of trees or whatever, they're going to see higher rates. So the problem has been that the utilities are saying, well, look, there's this cost shifting, and that's why we shouldn't do rooftop solar at all. That's not an excuse. The fact of the matter is all we need to do is to design programs that maximize not only the deployment of rooftop solar, but the equitable access to rooftop solar. And I think that the community solar concept is one of those ways that we can ensure that we get penetration of rooftop solar into low-income and other communities that otherwise might not be able to get it.
That was Tyson Slocum, Director of the Energy Program at Public Citizen. Learn more about the benefits of community solar programs by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since the 2000 U.S. election, where Vice President Al Gore won the national popular vote but lost the White House to George W. Bush after a controversial Supreme Court decision that left thousands of crucial Florida votes uncounted, a growing number of Americans have lost faith in the machinery of U.S. elections. The skepticism only deepened when Robert F. Kennedy Jr., along with election protection activists Harvey Wasserman and Bob Fitrakis, presented documentation that accused Republican election officials of employing a wide range of illegal and unethical tactics to fix the 2004 election, where George W. Bush defeated his Democratic challenger, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. The allegations focused on the state of Ohio and its 18 critical Electoral College votes, where, according to reports, at least 357,000 voters, the overwhelming majority of them Democratic, were prevented from casting ballots or did not have their votes counted in 2004. According to a recent article and forthcoming book by Wasserman and Fitrakis, U.S. elections are vulnerable to partisan dirty tricks using methods they call strip and flip. Historically, stripping has been based on race and centers on voter suppression tactics that includes the purging of minority voters from registration rolls, imposing restrictive voter ID laws, and establishing barriers to make voter registration and early voting more difficult for Democratic Party-leaning groups such as blacks, Hispanics, the young, and the poor. Flipping, they say, relates to electronic voting machines that are vulnerable to hacking and have no mechanism to verify vote totals, such as a paper trail. Your reporter spoke with author and activist Harvey Wasserman, who explains why he's concerned that the results of the 2016 national election could be open to manipulation and outright theft.
There's one thing that, and only one thing that you need to know about the 2016 election. There's many things, but the number one thing is the reality that 80% of the vote in the United States presidential election in 2016 will be cast on electronic voting machines, and they are completely unverifiable. There is no system in place in the United States in 2016 to verify the electoral outcome on these machines. Most of these machines were paid for with money that was voted by the Congress in 2002, the Help America Vote Act, and as a result, we will be conducting our election in this country. You know, millions of dollars spent all this time yelling, screaming, debating. But the bottom line is we're conducting this election on machines that are 10 years old. And, you know, I don't know anybody who has a personal computer or a cell phone that's 10 years old or even a desktop. And these machines are so easily hackable that there was a public demonstration done not long ago where a professor took an electronic voting machine and played Pac-Man on it. You know, it's ridiculous. And there is no accountability on the state level. So that you have a situation in Ohio, Michigan, Illinois, Iowa, Arizona, and North Carolina, where the governor and the secretary of state are both from the same party. And they can, at midnight, as was done in Ohio in 2004, simply flip the electronic vote count. And so the title of our book, which is forthcoming, is Strip and Flip Selection of 2016, because what they're doing is they're stripping, and there's a long history of this, of course, in the United States, they're stripping the voter rolls, mostly of African-Americans, Latinos, young people, people suspected of being liberals or progressives, and so that millions of Americans literally are being denied the right to vote. And then if that's not sufficient, then on election night, as happened in 2004, they can just flip the vote electronically, and no one will know the difference. And, you know, we get accused of being conspiracy theorists all the time. All you have to do is answer the simple question. Tell us exactly how will the electronic vote count be verified in 2016? There is no answer. So we're voting in black boxes, and governors and secretaries of state will have the capacity to flip the vote count in a matter of about 60 seconds. However they want to do it.
Harvey, I did want to ask you about this proprietary software that powers up these electronic voting systems and machines that are purchased or leased by state government. How is it that state officials of one sort or another or party officials could actually get into the guts of the vote count itself to manipulate the results. What kind of collusion are you alleging between these government and party officials and the companies that manufacture the software for these voting machines?
Well, they issue contracts to run these elections to the owners of those machines or to companies that specialize in manipulating the nature of the machines. In Ohio 2004, there was a no-bid contract given to a guy named Michael Connell. The electronic machines for the Ohio vote count in 2004 were in the basement of a building in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that also housed the servers for the Republican National Committee and for Karl Rove's email. And the guy who, Michael Connell, who was charged with doing the tallying, was a longtime Bush family associate, who died mysteriously, by the way, in a plane crash, single engine plane crash in 2008, while he was being deposed by us. You do have states do contract with companies to tally up the vote count, and while there's no public accountability, the governors and secretary of states are pretty much in charge of operating with the IT companies that do the vote count.
Well, Harvey, what are some of the important elements that you want our listeners to know about a sound plan to protect the vote in future elections?
Well, we advocate universal hand-counted paper ballots, a four-day weekend for national holiday for voting, universal automatic registration, with the registration rolls kept with a paper backup. The polls need to be run by students and elders working at $15 an hour. And we also, of course, need to get money out of politics. It has to be restored to campaign finance laws. Abolish the Electoral College, for God's sakes. The Electoral College is ridiculous.
That was longtime activist, author, and organizer Harvey Wasserman, who, along with Bob Fitrakis, has co-authored 6 books on election protection, including their forthcoming PowerPoint compendium titled The Strip and Flip Election of 2016. For more information and articles on election protection, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Political prisoner here in the state of New York. And I just want to give a shout out to brothers and sisters that are locked down, and particularly Jamil Alameen, Matulu Shakur, Sekou Odingo, brothers out there on the West Coast, Rochelle McGee, Chip, Hugo, brother Lenny Patel, brother stay strong, and keep Sister Asada Shakur free by any means necessary. All power to the people. As-salamu alaykum.
His name was Abdul Majid, and in his youth, he soldiered for the Black Panther Party in New York. When he was arrested in 1982, he was beaten badly and charged in the April 1981 shootout with a cop. He and his colleague, Black Panther Bashir Hamid, were tried three times before a conviction was returned. They were known as the Queens Two, Black revolutionary political prisoners of the state. Although it took three juries to return guilty pleas, the men continued to struggle against their imprisonment. That final jury, by the way, was obtained by the exclusion of black jurors from the panel. Abdul Majid was known during his radical youth as an organizer for the Ocean Hill Brownsville Tenants Association in Brooklyn, New York, working for the people. Abdul Majid, after 33 plus years in a prison cell, has returned to his fathers. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. The Trump Party. It's months from the conventions, but if today is any indication, the results are all but guaranteed. No matter the results of the election, the impact on the Republican Party is clear. After years of playing with its southern strategy, the party has been colonized by a northern real estate magnate, Donald J. Trump. Loud, bombastic, boastful, narrow-minded, bigoted, and vain, Trump now epitomizes the party. The party faithful have worshipped at the steps of the Chamber of Commerce and genuflected before the big bell on Wall Street. It's only natural that they would bow in the presence of a billionaire, Donald Trump. It has become, in essence, the party of business, and in furtherance thereof, it has turned a blind eye to the pains and needs of the poor and the dispossessed. It was not always so. It was the 1870s when the spirit of Lincoln animated the party. Its most loyal voter was the newly emancipated black people. Wives tossed their husbands out of their homes if they dared vote Democratic. But the Republicans, in their not-so-great compromise of the 1870s, supported Rutherford B. Hayes for president, who announced a let-it-alone policy allowing racist Southern forces to attack at will black voters. Black troops were removed from the South and incidentally marched to the West to fight Indians, and black Republicans were left to the tender mercies of the terrorists, groups like the Ku Klux Klan. That betrayal burned in black Americans for decades. In the 60s, the time of the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Liberation Movement, the Republicans once again turned their backs on blacks and waged a Southern strategy, an appeal to white nationalism, xenophobia, and anti-blackness. Donald J. Trump is the logical development of that process. Loud, bombastic, bullying, racist, he is the very embodiment of the so-called conservative movement. He is more. He has become the Republican Party, and Lincoln has left the building. He is the true leader of the newest version of the grand old party, the Trump Party. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Clintonism laid bare. Bill Clinton, perhaps the best raw political animal of his generation, said a mouthful recently, especially when he confronted activists from the ubiquitous Black Lives Matter movement. There, the primary political architect of the mass incarceration phenomenon of the 90s defended his position with classic Clintonian doublespeak. He argued that the imprisonment boom that he fathered was done to protect blacks from other blacks. Quote, Clinton, how can you defend those vicious gang leaders who sent 13-year-olds into the streets to do their killing? This, in response to Hillary Clinton's venal denunciation of super predators, which gave rise to the greatest imprisonment boom on earth, was defended by Clinton in a way only Bill Clinton could have done. Essentially, he argued, we did it for you. One needs to go back to the tortured prose of the Dred Scott decision to find something so audacious. There, that old slave owner and Chief Justice, Roger Brooke Taney, argued that the Negro was subjected to slavery for his own benefit. I guess great minds think alike, huh? Bill Clinton unleashed the greatest imprisonment boom in American history to protect black folks from black children, you know, the super predators. This is Clintonism. Neoliberalism equals so-called compassionate conservatism for the good of the natives. He didn't do it to employ tens of thousands of rural whites in the containment so-called corrections industry. He didn't do it to create tens of thousands of new state workers who would donate to the Democratic Party for generations. He didn't do it because it gave lower class whites a sense of entitlement and a recession-proof profession. He didn't do it because it was the new way that Democrats governed, tougher, meaner. He did it because he felt black pain. He did it for you. This is Clintonism. Wars for profit. Prisons for profit. More jails equal more jobs, right? More cops, more crime. See, it works out, doesn't it? Hillary Clinton apologized for her choice of words. Bill Clinton, being Bill Clinton, bragged about it. I did it for y'all, he yells. Voting for Clintonism promises more of the same. Hey, good luck with that. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Who is behind the establishment of the ISIS militants in Syria? How much influence does the U.S. government have today over those militants? What motivates Hillary Clinton to pursue warmongering policies abroad? Might we see genuine coordination between the U.S., Russia, and the Syrian army in the name of wiping out ISIS? Could the rise of Donald Trump in the United States presidential runoffs lead to the demise of the Republican Party and a fundamental shifting of the political landscape in America? On this week's Global Research News Hour, guest interviewer Colin Hamlin brings us a show devoted to some of the recent musings of prominent political researcher, historian, and commentator Webster Tarpley. On today's program, the U.S. elections, Syria, and the specter of international terrorism, a conversation with Webster Tarpley. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 8th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory in the heart of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Since September 2014, the world dollar price of oil has collapsed. It has gone from levels of $103 a barrel down to close to $30 today. That's a collapse of 70% in demand for dollars for the world's largest commodity measured in dollars. In this political and financial context, the central banks of Russia and China are buying gold for their central bank reserves at a fever pace. Not only that, the People's Bank of China recently announced it has abandoned its peg to the US dollar and diversify into a basket of currencies led by the euro. That comes from the article, Why Are Russia and China Buying Gold, Tons of It? By F. William Engdahl, posted April 6th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. No matter which name they go by, ISIS, ISIL, IS, or Daesh, the group has been deliberately engineered by the U.S. and Israel to achieve certain geopolitical goals. They are a religious, fundamentalist, Sunni terrorist organization created to terrorize and overthrow certain secular or Shiite Arab nations such as Syria and Iraq, but they are not just Islamic. They may be Muslims, and they may be advocating an Islamic state, but they are very much working towards the goals of Zionism. We have been inundated with propaganda surrounding the fraudulent war on terror, notably terms such as Islamic terrorism and radical Islam. But more accurate phrases would be Zio-Islamic terrorism and radical Zio-Islam. Secret military agencies such as the CIA and the Mossad pull the strings. That comes from the article, ISIS is a U.S.-Israeli creation, Top 10 Indications, by Makia Freeman, posted April 7th, originally appearing at the Freedom Articles. The strangulation of Greece is a case in point for a successful experiment on how to rob Europe of its social and physical assets, putting the population into extreme poverty, too weak to even protest. A left-wing government in the most strategically located NATO country was an absolute no-go. No doubt, Tsipras himself, his family, and his government were criminally blackmailed into submission. Not obeying may lead to death. Just read up on Mohammad Mossadegh, Iran, assassinated by the CIA in 1953, Patrice Lumumba, Congo, Kinshasa, murdered by the CIA in 1961, Salvador Allende, Chile, murdered by the CIA in 1973, Saddam Hussein, Iraq, assassinated by the Bush-Blair murderers in 2006, Muammar Gaddafi, Libya, by NATO thugs in 2011, under orders of Hillary Clinton, then U.S. Secretary of State, today leading Democratic U.S. presidential contender, and the list goes on. That comes from the article, Europe, Are the EU and Euro on the Verge of Collapse? By Peter Koenig, posted April 7th. Until now, the U.S. aristocracy, according to the expression of Alexander Hamilton, was composed exclusively of WASPs, or white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. However, a first exception was made in 1961 with Irish Catholic John Kennedy, whose election enabled a peaceful resolution of the problem of racial segregation, and a second in 2008 with the Kenyan Barack Obama, which enabled the illusion of racial integration. In any case, in neither of these cases did the elected official use his power to renovate the governing class. Donald Trump, with his straight-talking attitude, incarnates a form of populism which is opposed to the conventional manners of the politically correct, so dear to the WASPs. The uneasy alliance between the president of the National Governors Association, the governor of Utah, Gary Herbert, and Donald Trump clearly demonstrates that an agreement between Trump and the ruling class will be very difficult to establish. That comes from the article, Who Will Be the Next President of the United States? By Thierry Meissan, posted April 6th, originally appearing at Voltaire Network. The entire California coastline lies along the Ring of Fire, which has become much more active in recent years. Scientists assure us that it is only a matter of time before the state experiences absolutely horrific natural disasters, but most Californians have been lulled into a false sense of security. In the end, I believe that the great shaking that will come to the state of California will be just part of the great shaking that is coming to the United States as a whole. This great shaking is something that I discuss in my new book entitled The Rapture Verdict, which is all about Bible prophecy and the last days. I am fully convinced that the judgment of God is coming to America and that everything that can be shaken will be shaken. That comes from the article, The Exodus of People Moving Away from California is Becoming an Avalanche, by Michael Snyder. Posted April 7th, originally appearing at End of the American Dream. The Panama Papers tax haven leak is big. After all, the Prime Minister of Iceland resigned over the leak, and investigations are taking place worldwide over the leak. But the Panama Papers reporting mainly focuses on friends of Russia's Putin, Assad's Syria, and others disfavored by the West. Of course, Obama and Hillary Clinton enabled and supported Panama's ability to act as a tax evasion haven, so it's a little disingenuous for them now to say we should crack down on tax havens. That comes from the article, Panama Tax Haven Scandal, The Bigger Picture, by Washington's blog, posted April 6th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Colin Hamlin has been a longtime contributor to spoken word programs on radio station CKUW. This week he brings us a special interview with prominent historian, author, and analyst Webster Tarpley. As you will hear, Tarpley's analysis acknowledges the phony nature of the war on terrorism. However, he does seem to regard the war on ISIS as legitimate and sincere, naming actors like Saudi Arabia and Turkey as culprits in aiding and abetting the militants. Here now is Colin Hamlin.
All right, welcome to this edition of the Global Research News Hour. I'm your host, Colin Hamlin, broadcasting out of Winnipeg, Canada. Our guest for today's show is Webster Griffin Tarpley. Dr. Tarpley is a Fulbright scholar and a doctor of history, and he's also the author of several books, including the popular unauthorized biographies of both George Bush and Barack Obama. He currently hosts a weekly radio program called World Crisis Radio and is involved in the Tax Wall Street Party based out of Washington, D.C. The topic for our discussion today will be the U.S. election, global politics, the Syrian war, amongst other things relevant to civilization-loving people. I wanted to interview Dr. Tarpley specifically for a number of reasons. Being well-versed in modern history, Tarpley brings a thoroughly empirical and historically grounded perspective on current events. And in my humble opinion, his commitment to historical truth is a good antidote for popular mythologies and impotent narratives that are unable to deviate from culturally sanctioned political correctness. So I'm sure it will be a lively discussion today. So I'm pleased to give you Dr. Webster Tarpley. Webster, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and thank you for your very kind words.
Could you give an example of a government in, let's say, the last 100 years that exemplifies for you what the proper and best role of government could be in terms of human development, peace, security, and human flourishing?
Like, yes, what this would be the New Deal of Franklin Delano Roosevelt here in the United States, starting in 1933. It reached a high point in terms of domestic reforms around 1936 or 1937, but the New Deal government then went on to pass the Lend-Lease law, which kept Great Britain, Soviet Union, and China in the war, prevented them from collapsing in all three cases, the U.S. production during 1941. And then this entire achievement, even after Roosevelt was no longer with us, it took the form of the Bretton Woods Agreement of 1944, which was essentially a New Deal for the world, meaning that the economic reconstruction of the war-torn areas was facilitated, and it was the best world monetary system we have had before or since. Nothing since has come close in terms of actual economic development. And I say actual. You read figures on gross domestic product. Half the time, that's derivatives, speculation, various kinds of swindles. We've got to focus on tangible, physical wealth, right? Hard commodities. Finance is not an industry. Steel is an industry, but finance is not an industry. So even the language has lost this distinction. So obviously the New Deal had flaws, right? Because there was a powerful internal opposition coming from the Wall Street banks, and there were also problems with the Southern Democrats who got themselves organized as of about 1937, a group of racist Bourbon Southern Democrats, as they're called here, began to counter-organize Roosevelt. But he was even when Dr. New Deal had to step aside and be replaced by Dr. Win the War, there was still plenty there to represent domestic reforms. I mean, the idea that an employer would give you health care benefits, that's something that comes out of the the war experience here, when you couldn't raise wages because there were wage controls, but you could offer all these wonderful fringe benefits. That's how the American people learned what a fringe benefit was, because before that they hardly knew.
So just to kind of globalize this perspective now, one of the issues in the debate is, of course, the conflict in Syria. All the candidates have more or less a loosely defined position on it. Could you give your summary of what is really at stake there, and what are the real issues for someone concerned about what they hear in the news?
We also have to be worried about Europe, right? I was in Europe last autumn, in Italy and in Germany. Germany, in particular, people are extremely upset about the refugee flows, and of course, the refugee flows are a humanitarian catastrophe in anybody's book. We should probably start with the Iraq War, right, that Hillary Clinton voted for, and the essentially what is now called ISIS, or the Caliphate, or Daesh. This was a creation of General David Petraeus and his group during their surge, with the idea that they couldn't face the Iraqi population in a united front. They had to split it, so they had to create Sunni versus Shiite violence, and they pursued that with some extent. So this was Zarqawi and his group of Ansar, or really just al-Qaeda, in Iraq. And so this has been going on for quite a while. About a little bit less than a year ago, we had these papers from U.S. military intelligence that they saw that there was a definite potential to create a kind of a Sunni stan or Sunni entity there in the middle, the emptier areas of Syria and Iraq. And that then went on. As I said before, the beginning of the war in Syria, there never was a phase of peaceful protest in Syria. This is absolute falsehood. There had been violent, armed terrorists operating against Assad going back to the early 1980s, and that never stopped. It was continuous. So that when these people in March of 2011 or thereabouts came out into the streets protesting Assad, they were already armed. There were already third force people there who were making sure that these demonstrations turned violent.
Were those indigenous Syrians even in the 80s and 90s?
I think, some. But the point is, there never would have been a rebellion without foreign fighters deliberately brought in, paid for by Saudi Arabia, and then facilitated in by Turkey, by the Erdogan government of Turkey. Right? And today it's lopsided. Right? There's a substantial majority of these fighters are from outside of Syria, right? And I think it always seemed to me that the first point of pacification is get all foreign fighters out. Now, the ones invited by the government, that's different because that's allowable. But foreign fighters as a rebel force, this is not allowable. Now, the thing is, as time goes on, though, and especially lately, you can see that the U.S. is controlling less of these people, right? I think you could say as of about last summer, when the general commanding the U.S. Central Command, General Austin, when he came out there and said, we got, what did he say, 5-6 fighters trained in a $500 million program. To me, that said, this at this point, the U.S. has very little influence over these terrorist rebels inside Syria. They are, after all, paid for by Saudi Arabia, either government or individuals, and certainly then promoted in by President Erdogan.
Do you think
Turkey.
Some of that was because of the heat that Clinton got and her involvement in that, and that they had to maybe take a step back?
Yeah, but look, you got to get the idea, right? In other words, I know everybody in the world loves to blame the U.S. for everything, and I think that is now obsolete. In other words, if you want to blame somebody for what's going on right now, you'd have to blame Saudi Arabia and the Turkish government. In other words, that's how it happened. And I think we can even show that other forces have not done what they needed to do. We have here a group of insubordinate and disgruntled officers around General David Petraeus, whose career was ended, Stanley McChrystal, who got fired because he was insulting the civilian leadership, and we've got some others. We had a guy called General John Allen, who last summer tried to set up the infamous no-fly zone safe haven for terrorists in northern Syria, and Obama repudiated him. And then finally this Allen was forced out in September and October of last year. So I think right now the U.S. posture, the U.S. is not the main problem in this. As I say again, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and those international fighters. But now here's what it comes down to. If you look at your map, take a look at the Euphrates River and take a look at the town of Jarablus, sometimes written Jarabulus, but I think it's closer to Jarablus. And then go along that border area and get over to the town of Efren, north of Aleppo. And you've got a stretch there of about 100 kilometers or 60 miles, which is the gate, the logistical portal through which the weapons, the fuel, the money, the duped psychotic recruits are sent in to Syria, right, to ISIS, by forces in Turkey, because they could end this anytime they wanted to. It's clear that Erdogan regards ISIS as his puppet state or his irregular army, a secret army, if you want, and they do what Erdogan wants. The U.S. is not in a position to tell Erdogan what to do. He is thought to be a high official of the Muslim Brotherhood, and he's also thought to be the practical day-to-day commander of ISIS. And he's got his son has been reportedly selling contraband oil out of the ISIS area on the world market. And then his daughter is reported to be the head of a hospital which treats primarily wounded jihadis, right? People who have been fighting in the civil war, and they're the only ones. That's on the Turkish side. But let's look at this Jarablus corridor, as I call it, Jarablus to Efren. Again, 60 miles, 100 kilometers. If you want to end the Syrian civil war, which I think ought to be everybody's first goal, you need to interdict that corridor. In other words, you've got to close that gate using ground forces and air and whatever else you've got. You've got to cut that supply line. You've got to deprive ISIS of those logistics. And if you do that, ISIS will collapse within a month or two, with no question about it. And what you see is the U.S. has not done this, and that's a serious problem. I also have to point out Russia has not done this. They have not done it, and they could have, right? Because this is – everybody knows this. This was even everybody on the inside. Last December, Susan Rice at the White House gave a briefing off the record, right? So we are assuming it's Susan Rice. And then the journalist came out and said one of the points mentioned was the need to cut that 100-kilometer stretch east of Jarablus on the Euphrates. Now, it's also true that the Turkish government has more or less said that they would regard cutting that corridor as casus belli in particular, and there was a war. If you look at the stretch, the border between Turkey and Syria, you will see that the Kurds, starting all the way over in the Far East, they have progressively taken over that border, right? The Kobane fighting some years ago, that was a big deal in that regard. And there were a couple of other places that were taken over last summer. So the ability of ISIS to get supplies now comes down to this 60-mile stretch. And many countries could close it. The U.S. could close it. Russia could close it. If Germany is really concerned about the influx of refugees, the Bundeswehr could be sent in there, and they could close it. And you'd have to say to Turkey, I'm very sorry, but your pro-terrorist activities are intolerable, and we won't allow it. And I think, therefore, if you're going to blame somebody, you want to blame one person, blame Erdogan. It's just simple, right? You look at the map, you look where the logistics go, who could close it? Well, the easiest way to close it is for Turkey to do it. I think the U.S. is reluctant to do it because that would fracture the NATO alliance. I would urge them to proceed anyway. That's not an alliance worth having. If
we look at the really what matters here, it definitely seems like overall, like you mentioned, that ending the war in Syria is really the main issue. The best thing we can do for a refugee is end the war that's causing the refugees. We don't actually have to take in that many if we can end that war. But when we look at ISIS controlling a large part of the country, and when we look at the contemporary debate in the U.S., which is largely framed around, well, we can't end the war if Assad is still in power, and that's kind of the issue that they keep bringing up. How could we frame, like, we know that Assad is not a perfect person, it's a dictatorship, he has problems, but why is a stable Syria with Assad in power better than the alternative of overthrowing him or dividing the country or having ISIS be a long-term presence there?
I would say the first point of international affairs is to work with existing governments. That in today's world, any government is a potential ally against non-state actors. In other words, militias, terrorist organizations, things like ISIS or similar things, Boko Haram, it's a long list. Any government is likely, not always, but frequently, probably, going to be better than one of those terroristic, chaotic non-state actors. I visited Libya in the summer of 2011 under the NATO bombing. I then visited Syria in November, just as the big phase of the civil war was starting up. I've been in some other areas, but the problem with this situation is you've got to rely on existing governments. Now, let's look at Assad. What we're seeing here is a clash that has gone back to the time of Nasser, and I myself have a large sympathy for President Nasser of Egypt. Starting out in the late 50s, right? Anti-imperialism. Kicking the British and the French out of the Suez Canal, using that money for national development. Right? Modern Egypt is unthinkable without the Aswan High Dam. Populist measures, that is to say the bread subsidy, the cooking oil subsidy, the gasoline subsidy, these are important things, and they're eminently worthwhile. Now, of course, some doctrinaire market fetishist will come along and say, oh, no, this violates the rules of the British School of Ricardo or the Austrian School of von Hayek or some other crackpot economist who's nothing but an apologist for very greedy ruling class interests. They will object. But for the average person, you could go to Syria under Assad, again, November 2011, and the bread subsidy was still working. You had a beautiful loaf of bread for, almost nothing. You could get cooking oil, olive oil. This was available at a very low price. There was a problem already with furnishing diesel oil or azut, as they called it, right, for internal heating and then some kinds of cooking. So with Gaddafi in Libya, the case is probably the clearest, right, that Libya had become the number one country in Africa on the United Nations Human Development Index, and that they were beating all kinds of countries, better than Brazil, better than Ukraine at the time, and that was before the fighting. The other thing is Gaddafi had been the sponsor of the greatest civil engineering projects in recent world history. That is to say, the man-made pipeline where he took aquifers under the Sahara and using the largest steel tubes that were available anywhere in the world, and those were manufactured in Libya at their own factory. Those steel tubes were used then to get the water to the coastal cities. And the fact that human life can go on at all in Libya right now has got to do with Gaddafi's great man-made river. So the point is, imperialism in general, the British, say, start with them, they don't want to be confronted by a modernizing, authoritarian, often military, secular regime. No, they don't want that. They want benighted, superstitious, backward, misogynistic, obscurantists, right? That's what they like. So they like, you know, the Caliph al-Baghdadi, right? That's their kind of guy because he's so much easier to fight, right? His atrocities alienate the world. Nobody wants to work with him. He isolates himself. He defeats himself, in effect.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Looking at Libya, Iraq, Syria, they definitely seem to be major setbacks for civilization. Is it primarily geopolitical forces? Like, we know that Russia has a port in Syria and the U.S., and everyone's really vying for interests there. But how much do you think is really a drive within the politics of imperialist regimes to perpetuate war because that controls the dialogue, certain companies make a lot of money? Clinton favors better in a time of war, I think, than Sanders. If there was peace on Earth, then I think people would be more receptive to more progressive voices.
I didn't understand your point about Hillary Clinton.
So I'm trying to say that I'm trying to look at if we can see the wars as a problem for humanity, then the driving force behind war is the reason why Hillary Clinton supports war is because the people that she listens to, her advisors, are very interested in global domination, as it were. Or is it more of a fact that perpetual war supports a politics that is favorable for people like Clinton, who are more pro-war and more proponents of military action? So I'm just trying to think.
I think the first thing is, I wouldn't say war as the goal, but the destruction of these countries. In other words, the original idea of the Arab Spring, right, was to let's send out Julian Assange, right, with a limited hangout, fresh from CIA headquarters, and let's have that limited hangout, you know, attack Ben Ali of Tunisia and the rest of them, right? And the so-called the fake Arab Spring. The Arab Spring, a complete fake, completely designed by MI6, CIA, and so forth. But then the idea is a regime like Gaddafi can say no, and they did say no. You go to Egypt, Mubarak said no. They said, we want to have a U.S. base in Egypt. No. We want Egyptian troops in fighting in Iraq in the first and second Gulf Wars. The answer to that was no. We want you to have a military alliance with the Israelis. No, and so forth. Right. So these governments that can say no, they have to be fought. And again, the Muslim Brotherhood was invented by the British. This is British intelligence in Egypt in the late 1920s found that anti-imperialist, anti-British sentiment was growing in the Waft Party. The Waft Party was the main sort of bourgeois party at the time. And they found that this group was feeling nationalistic. So they said, we have to concoct something that's going to say no, that is not the way to go, that we want to be benighted and backward, and we've got to turn back the clock on the status of women and all sorts of other social reforms. In other words, the big threat in the 1920s was the successful reforms of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in Turkey, right? This is, to me, one of the great heroes of the 20th century. Obviously imperfect, but still a bringer of civilization, right? Every other country that lost World War I became fascist, but not Turkey under Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. So if you look at the continuity, it's essentially Nasserism on the one side in any form you want, right? The Gaddafi is explicitly inspired by Nasser. I've talked to people over there about this. Similarly, the Assad family, Egypt, of course, the PLO, all of these have this original idea of Nasserism. And the only thing you can fight that with, as the imperialists figured out, is this benighted Muslim Brotherhood approach, which is essentially turn back the clock, get the women back into the harem, or keep them inside the house, or make them cover themselves, and so forth. Right? The things that Ataturk had attacked. Now, there's also an instinctive hatred of independent third world countries. We've just had the Washington Post and the New York Times in two articles have found that the reason the U.S. went along with the bombing of Libya, this is now March 2011, was Mrs. Clinton. And notice, the U.S. was not, repeat, not the prime mover on that. That was Nicolas Sarkozy. And you have to know that there is a secret treaty since the British and the French are now so weak, they cannot act alone. They have a treaty which sets up a process by which they will act together. And they had signed a treaty in a specific subset of this treaty in late 2010, where the British and the French said, in effect, we're going to be attacking a country in North Africa, which is sparsely populated, a lot of desert, but a lot of oil. We're going to be attacking that country. So that's Libya. And that was called Operation Harmattan, Harmattan, one of the winds of the Mediterranean. So Bernard-Henri Lévy of France, the philodoxer, I guess we'd call him, he was out there in Benghazi telling stories about imminent massacres. He convinced Sarkozy that this was the case, and Sarkozy then convinced Mrs. Clinton, and then the British were also in on the game. So that's how that actually happened, right? And the Russians failed to veto. Like, well, the easiest thing in the world is to veto that, but that was, of course, Medvedev, whose faction still exists, right, and still does things. But in those days, it was the Medvedev faction that said, "We're not going to veto it. We're going to go along with that." And Medvedev came under attack from the Russian ambassador in Libya, Chamov, who said that this was essentially an act of treason on the part of that president at that time. So today we have Putin, so we're better off. But you also have to, you know, you got to look at this with your eyes wide open. Finally, the thing that I think people have to understand, Hillary Clinton is a warmonger. She's a systematic, implacable, incorrigible warmonger. And one of the main reasons for this is obviously because she's in cahoots with these bankers and these strategists and so forth, right? All the imperialist think tanks that we have. She's all that. But here's the main thing. She's a feminist, and she feels that she's going to be mocked as a weak woman unless she's the biggest warmonger in the room. She's got to be the biggest warmonger in sight, because otherwise she's deathly afraid that somebody says, "Oh, you're soft, you're a sentimentalist, you're another one of these weak women." And her method of compensating for that is to be the warmonger. In other words, there's got to be no space to her right. She's got to be the extreme right wing on every warmonger meeting. And I think this is certainly one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton should never be allowed to be president, because ultimately she does this to avoid the perception of weakness. But if you understand how she's thinking, you can see that her behavior is the acme of weakness. In other words, that's the dictionary definition of weakness, is that you feel so impacted inside. You feel so weak inside that you've got to overcompensate for that with a bellicose and jingoistic demeanor on the outside. So she's not qualified. She's actually psychologically disqualified from being president.
So one of the last issues I want to talk about is international terrorism, and I have a specific question for you. From my point of view, the issue with terrorism, we hear a lot about it on the news, and I realize that people want to know what's going on in the world and they want to be informed, but it seems to me that terrorism kills so few people that really the problem with terrorism is overreacting to it in a sense, that that's really what a terrorist tries to do, is to try to control or influence the politics in a way that benefits them. And I think we hear these crazy things about, we'll bomb entire countries. If there's a terrorist living near you, we'll bomb you. We'll upheave the whole entire world in order to reduce terrorism. But I don't know if this is a fair perspective, but it seems to me that really the main problem with terrorism is that we spend so much attention on it. Really, terrorists are really weak. They kill a few people a year. Like, a bus rolls into the ditch, it kills more people than a terrorist. But we're not going to stop all buses. And of course, that's nothing to downplay the loss of lives and how no one wants to live in that kind of state of affairs. But it just seems that sometimes the best thing to do is to really get your own bearings and not play the game of the terrorists, and police actions, regular. If there's a specific issue, like in Syria, we want to settle the civil war, if that's a generator of peace. What do you think about that?
Well, again, on Syria, you've got to cut that Jarablus corridor, and that will have to be done with the violent means. In other words, I don't see how you could be reticent about bombing ISIS. I think ample military force could play a very useful role, but it's got to be the kind of force that brings things to an end. In other words, that makes resistance and attacks coming from this quarter cease.
But
we got to look at what you're talking about over time. I'd say if we're in the year 2000 or 2001, I think you could say, well, Al-Qaeda, what's Al-Qaeda? I have to also point out, I have never accepted the U.S. government version of September 11, 2001. I've written a book about this. I think it's the definitive treatment among the ones out so far, which is that this was done by a rogue or renegade faction, a parallel government or deep state inside the U.S. bureaucracy, for the purpose of starting Samuel Huntington's Wars of Civilization, which it has more or less done. In other words, it shaped the entire outlook for a generation or more, almost now. So my standard take on Al-Qaeda at the beginning, say, 2001, 2002, was, yes, there is Al-Qaeda, but they do not have the means to direct these planes across, vast stretches and blow up the Pentagon and hit the towers in New York and have them come down. All of this is so complicated, and so it requires so much preparation, including on the ground in a number of these cases, that Al-Qaeda can't do that. What can Al-Qaeda do? Al-Qaeda can blow up a supermarket. Al-Qaeda can blow up a bus. Al-Qaeda can kill people in an airport or a plane, things like this. But then you have to see, over time, this then changed. And within, say, 8, 9, 10 years after 9/11, you actually have an Al-Qaeda and other similar organizations, competitors or, collaborators, whatever they are, that can do more. In the sense, when I went to Syria in November of 2011, I was able, I hope people will go and look at this on tarpley.net, my website. It's an interview that I did from Damascus, Syria, in there's this famous chair where you sit, and then behind you there's a fountain and a large open square. This was Russia Today, and I told Russia Today that what was happening in Syria were death squads with significant foreign participation were attacking civilians, because I had been in Homs, right, the cradle of the revolution in Homs, and we'd gone to a hospital, and the hospital said that the woman doctor that I talked to, woman doctor, right, that was on thanks to Assad, and she said she was going to go home, but she was always afraid for her life because there were snipers on rooftops, and they were killing people. They were killing mothers and children. They were killing mothers when they came to get their kids. They were, killing people in the streets, and she had to get home. And she wanted more of the Syrian army to come in there. She said, "What's wrong with Assad? Why doesn't he send in the whole panoply of forces?" She said, "I want tanks here. I want actual Syrian army snipers up on the roofs of these houses and so forth." So what had happened was death squads, as I said to Russia Today, these death squads coming from abroad, I was not exactly sure from where, but turned out, you know, that at the beginning, a relatively limited phenomenon caused by death squads. Now, over this time, these groups have become more numerous, and they've become veterans. They've been through Libya. They've been through Syria. They've been through some stuff in Egypt. They're in the Egyptian Sinai right now. So they kill people. And I think right now you'd have to look at that threat differently. In other words, I think it's fairly clear that the fanatics and lunatics who make up the leadership of ISIS would certainly be glad to blow up the Vatican, as they've said, or make other attacks. So
you do think that the, I would take ISIS that seriously.
In other words, I don't think this is the time for something like unilateral disarmament in regard to these people, because the fact is they are now there. In other words, a lot of these people were shocked into militancy by 9/11, right? By this fantastic story that crazy old Osama bin Laden in his cave could actually do these things, right? The craziest story. In other words, if you believe that story, you're in la-la land, and then you can imagine that you jihadi, you're going to go out and do something similar. And a lot, you know, a whole generation has fallen for that, and probably the beginnings of another generation. So I would not minimize that. In other words, you can go back and reconstruct how this threat emerged, right, starting with 9/11, to be sure, and with the help of the CIA and the help of MI6. But the fact is, like Hitler, it's now there. So you can't ignore the existence of it just because you know the dirty ways in which it was created.
So, I mean, certainly, like, if you're saying then that the defeat of ISIS really has to happen, I mean, if it's the Syrian army that's primarily doing it, then I don't think you can realistically expect the West to help out in that effort, given that ISIS is fighting the Syrian regime, which is an enemy of the West or of the.
I wouldn't be so sure of that. In other words, I wouldn't be so pessimistic. I had the experience last summer, autumn. The Tax Wall Street Party launched a campaign, Get Allen Out. Fire Allen. His title at that time was ISIS Czar. He was the top guy in the State Department working with Kerry on the coalition. So it meant that Allen became the advocate of Saudi Arabia and Turkey. And he was constantly scheming to try to go around Obama. Because look, here's the other thing. Obama is, disappointing on some points, a disaster on other points. Here's the main thing, though. He's not the warmonger you think. He has repeatedly rejected plans to escalate the Syrian war. At one point he said, people come to me with a bunch of half-baked mumbo-jumbo about what to do in Syria. In other words, create this no-fly zone and safe zone for terrorists. By the way, the no-fly zone and the safe zone for terrorists is exactly the area you'd have to block. In other words, it's right below the Jarablus corridor, right? It's right along that stretch of border. So the idea is you can't go there, so nobody can interfere with ISIS. But Obama has done that, and that quote about the half-baked mumbo-jumbo, I think, is important. And he's been opposed by this clique of officers that nobody writes about, but it's fairly obvious: Petraeus, Allen, McChrystal, others, Breedlove, the NATO commander, at least until recently, was one of them also. So,
but are you suggesting that you could envision NATO sorties flying in support of the Syrian army against ISIS? Could that?
Well, you wouldn't have to call it in support of the Syrian army. Sure, absolutely. Why not? Merkel is a fool. When I was in Germany last October, November, I gave a big speech near Frankfurt. I said, look, if you want, they're all so worried about these refugees, I think with some reason. If you want to stop that, you have military forces. Why don't you close that Jarablus corridor? In other words, this whole thing is so vulnerable and so artificial. It depends so much on sanctuaries, in effect, right, on zones where they can run wild. Right now what you have is this. The Syrian army has the Russian Air Force. But then we have the Kurds. Now, we can't forget the Kurds. The YPG Kurds, which are the best Kurds, and including women, very gallant ladies. You've got the PKK Kurds. And then you've got this Talibani operation in northern Iraq. The northern Iraq Kurds, at least their leadership, I think, is frankly rotten. The PKK, somewhat better. The best of the YPG. So if you look at that stretch along the border, right, the only way that the YPG Kurds were able to take Kobane and cut one of the main roads in the area is thanks to the U.S. Air Force. And you've had, you know, the capture of Ramadi. They now seem to be – they're building up for an attack on Mosul. So I think, you know, you've got an established fact that there's a cooperation between the U.S. Air Force and Naval Air with the Kurds. So somehow you bring this together. The other thing you've got to factor in – now, this is coming from my friend Thierry Maison of the Voltaire Network, right? Le Réseau Voltaire. He's been in Damascus, Syria for the entire war. He's always talking about coordination behind the scenes between Putin and Obama. Most recently, that Obama and Putin have decided between them that Erdogan must go, that his activities, right, his, you know, betrayal of all sides, right, shooting down Russian planes, you know, insulting the U.S., you know, duplicity, supporting terrorism, enabling the logistics, that he has to go. And the crowning piece, I urge people to read Tarpley.net and listen to these broadcasts. The last time I had Maison on, he said that the intelligence world sort of the good guys in the Middle East is that Erdogan is the prime suspect in the Belgian bombing in particular and in the Paris bombing of last November. And these are – he wants to get a Kurdish state which would be a puppet state of Turkey. Got it? So it would be taking the land which the YPG has liberated – or it's a complicated question – but which they've carved out of northern Turkey. But they've liberated it from ISIS in the most recent round of events that project has been repeatedly blocked. And that when it is blocked, then Erdogan lashes out with bombs in Paris and bombs in Brussels. So that's Maison's account, and I think that compels quite a bit of attention. And again, this notion of a secret coordination between Obama and Putin, I think that's eminently plausible. And I know from here, the reason you'd want to do that is we have these lunatics, right? We have the Republican Party who, if they found out you were coordinating with Assad, whatever else they had been saying about it, they could have been calling for that the day before. If they found out you were doing it, they'd try to impeach you. So that's one thing. And I think we don't really know that much about the anti-Putin opposition. I mean, we know some things, and they're bad, and they're there, and you know they may have ways of trying to threaten Putin over this issue of cooperating with the U.S.
Dr. Tarpley, we're running low on time.
Sure.
What final thoughts about our discussion today? Anything that you want to remind the audience of as they think about the world and what needs to be
sure.
done?
Sure. I would urge people in Canada to think about what you can do to raise this issue of fascism. And the ideal thing would be the U.S. ambassador in Ottawa is called in, and he's told the fascist Trump is unacceptable, and if that guy gets to power, we're going to abrogate whatever we can abrogate and stop cooperating in a whole number of ways, right? And then the Canada might have to think about their own border. It's not just, a wall along the Mexican border and the deportation of 12 million people that we have with Trump, but that, you know, other countries may feel security threats. In other words, whatever you can do to raise this question of fascism in the context of Trump. And I think one of the main demands is that you can't treat Trump and his supporters as if they were other normal people, right? We just have a guy called Roger Stone. He's a provocateur. He's a political saboteur going back to Nixon, right? He started off with the Watergate scene, right? The committee to reelect the president in in 1972. And this guy's now, he's saying, Trump has said, if he doesn't get the Republican nomination, there will be riots in Cleveland. And now this Roger Stone is saying there will be riots. There's going to be days of rage. And he also says we will have the hotel rooms, numbers and hotels of the delegates, and we will send people there to harass them. And I think a very sensible commentator said the Republican Party ought to ban at least Roger Stone from the Republican convention. So you got to be aware of this. The other thing I think is, you know, within the councils of NATO, the idea that the Syrian civil war could be ended, and that what Turkey in particular is doing, and I think Erdogan and his friend Davutoglu are quite isolated in this, I think. I don't see a lot of support elsewhere inside NATO for this, but that they have got to be called to account, that that probably Putin and Obama are right, that that the Erdogan government is simply outrageous, intolerable, unacceptable, and that, you know, anybody, Turkish generals, any forces inside the country, should be invited to restore order inside Turkey. And other than that, I am hoping, this is my hope, is that if the Republican Party becomes extinct as a national party, or at least becomes a definitively minority party with 10 or 20% of the vote, they'd probably still have people in Congress and things like this, but they wouldn't dominate the Congress, they wouldn't dominate the presidency, they wouldn't dominate the Supreme Court. After that, the perspective is, in my view, that the Democratic Party is likely to split into two parts, Wall Street Democrats with Hillary Clinton, and then this other New Deal, pro-labor, progressive group, which it's somehow gravitated to Bernie Sanders because he's all there was. But there are even within the Democratic Party on that side today, there are people that are better than Bernie Sanders. The net effect of that, though, would be to shift the entire world political situation quite a few degrees to the left. In other words, I would encourage people to see the recent past, especially since 1968, which is when the New Deal coalition in the U.S. broke up over the Vietnam War, when Nixon won the election. And after that, we've had such horrible times. We've had declining standards of living. We've had union busting. We've had imperialist wars that were generally lost. We've had cultural barbarism, clearly declining standards of living, that a new era of human progress could open up if you had this sea change in the United States. In other words, the American people, I would have to say, the American people have always been anti-fascist, in many ways the most anti-fascist, because we never had appeasement. We never had Chamberlain or Daladier appeasing Hitler. We never allied with Hitler. I'm afraid there was this Hitler-Stalin pact for a couple of years. There never was a Hitler-Roosevelt pact. And we've never had a fascist government. If you understand fascism in my terms, there's never been one. So that's good. But if Trump goes down, the Republican Party breaks up in that process, then we get essentially we get a debate between the Wall Street Democrats and the further left Democrats. This could be a great boon for the world. This could, again, move the entire political axis 5-10 degrees to the left, right, for the whole planet. And that's I think that would be a great achievement. So I urge, if you can visualize that process, find out ways you can join in. Let me recommend, I represent the Tax Wall Street Party. If you go to my website, tarpley.net, you can get a free subscription to really a daily briefing. It's called our daily briefing. It comes to you in the middle of the night, but it's essentially a strategic overview of the world and or, you know, topics of great immediate historical interest. Like this week, we went back and reviewed at least one of the American conventions that led to a party splitting up, right? The Democratic Party in 1860, which broke into two parts. That was tragic because that led to a civil war. But now, if the Republican Party breaks up, this will essentially mean that a whole nightmare world of ideology will have been lifted from the minds of many people, because it'll become discredited. It'll take months and months, but it'll die out. So come to Topley.net, subscribe to the Tax Wall Street Party newsletter, a daily briefing. It's really more than a newsletter. It's like a publication in itself, day by day. If you want, very soon we'll be starting a service from here, which will be a one-hour daily television broadcast on news and cultural and political themes. Now, what we've seen, of course, is that some of these libertarian broadcasters, right, some of the loud-mouthed ones, you're probably familiar with them, they're in tremendous crisis because they were all backing the Rand Paul dynasty of barbarians, right, people who wanted to lower the lower wages, shred the social safety net, and so on. Now that Rand Paul has gone, he may not even hang on to his Senate seat. These people have all shifted to Trump. So you've got this sort of very neat package of the most retrograde, most backward, most benighted people, all wrapped up with Trump. So if you defeat them, it's going to be good, but so in the meantime,
we're going to have to leave it there, Dr. Tarpley.
In the meantime, there's a great void in broadcasting, which we will attempt to fill. So keep in touch. Tarpley.net, and on Twitter, it's Webster Tarpley on Twitter and on Facebook.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks this week to special guest interviewer Colin Hamlin. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.